on the tenth day of Bushmas, my friend.
Lie down, people. Lay down your Bill of Rights. Tell James Madison we had to let those amendments go. The opium crop was blown away. Let them poppies grow. Thanks to U.S. troops, it's back today. Only goes to show. Go down Wall Street, sell off my shares today. Tell my broker, put it all in blow.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO is launching a national grassroots fight to defend Social Security against the Bush privatization attempt. Actions in San Francisco and in Boston on Wednesday singled out financial firms like Charles Schwab, urging them not to assist Social Security privatization. Tim Paulson is the executive director of the San Francisco Labor Council.
Social Security is not broken. The only thing that's attempted to be broken is the promise to working men and women that when they retire that they will have guaranteed benefits. And we believe that corporate America is just drooling right now, waiting to get a piece of our retirement and to make sure that they can get profit off of it and to let it get into the speculative realm.
The AFL-CIO believes that private financial companies rocked by corporate crime and scandal in recent years should never be trusted to handle Social Security accounts. These rallies are only the opening rounds in labor's battle to defend Social Security.
Trade unions in Africa's last true monarchy are entering a second day of strikes aimed at democratic reforms. Swaziland has begun drafting a constitution that the Federation of Trade Unions says will give the monarchy more power. King Mswati III has been criticized of living a rich lifestyle while most of the country's population lives in poverty. More than a third of Swazis are HIV positive. The union is seeking a constitution that will include separation of power between branches of government, as well as a respect for women and human rights. In Boston, a civil suit against a union that represents uniformed officers with the rank of sergeant or higher began this week. The suit was filed 3 years ago by Karen Kelly, a former bookkeeper for the Boston Superior Officers Federation. She claims in the suit that the union allowed its former vice president, Thomas W. Nolan, to sexually harass her. Kelly says between September 1999 and December 2000, Nolan repeatedly called her indecent pet names and sent her emails and left phone messages asking for sexual favors. The lawsuit alleges that when Kelly refused Nolan, her pay was cut, work conditions changed, and her workload increased. According to the Boston Globe, Federation President Joseph Gillespie says Kelly wasn't harassed and her pay was cut as a cost-saving measure. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The Multinational Monitor has released its top 10 worst companies of 2004, topping the list, Abbott Laboratories. According to the Monitor, at the end of 2003, Abbott raised the price of its life-or-death anti-AIDS drug, Norvir, by 400%. The company claims that the increase was to cover research and development. The stipulation, the price increase does not apply if purchased along with another Abbott drug. Critics say that gives Abbott an unfair market advantage and forces users to only use their drugs.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Are you tired of progressives spending all their energy on defensive struggles where a victory simply maintains the status quo? We are too, and we're doing something about it. At ReclaimDemocracy.org, we're taking the initiative to revoke corporate power and restore citizen authority over corporations to enable genuine progress on the many issues that we all care about. Get involved. Visit us online at ReclaimDemocracy.org or call 406-582-1224.
Let's take another peek into the lifestyles of the rich and cranky. Poor Lloyd Blankfein. He's the chief operating officer at the Wall Street giant Goldman Sachs, but it's reported that he made, quote, only $600,000 in salary last year. That's truly sad, but before you send a check to the Blankfein Relief Fund, note that at the end of the year, Goldman Sachs put a little something extra in Lloyd's stocking, a bonus of $20 million. He's but one of the top Wall Streeters who've danced into this new year with a total of $15.9 billion in executive bonuses. While wages of America's highly productive workers are being held beneath the rate of inflation by the corporate elite, these Wall Street darlings are porking up, with top investment bankers hiking their annual bonuses by some 15% over the previous year's haul. You'll be delighted to know that this showering of corporate largesse on themselves has led the fortunate bankers to, quote, rediscover conspicuous consumption, in the words of one news report. Manhattan's dealers in luxury goods are experiencing a surge of giddy impulse buyers. $6 million apartments on Manhattan's Tony Upper East Side are suddenly in demand, as are such show-off cars as the Maybach, an exclusive line of Mercedes-Benz autos with sticker prices starting at $315,000. There is a sense of entitlement among those wallowing in this windfall. After all, they say, we work hard. Of course, migrant farm workers work hard, too, but oh well, never mind. Even the super-rich bankers who try to be what they think of as modest are lost in this culture of excess. As one said, I have a sailboat, a motorboat, an apartment, an SUV. What could I possibly need? He paused for a second, then said, maybe a little Porsche for the Hamptons house. This is Jim Hightower saying, money, it's all a matter of perspective and fat bonuses.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library. So make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Exposes political corruption and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, let's go to Ann Landers today. Ann Landers, what? Hey, welcome, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, Ann Landers. Well, Ann is dead now, but her tradition is being carried on by Kathy Mitchell and Marcy Sugar. And why is he talking about Ann Landers? Follow along with me. This is going to lead right into the Republican National Committee. I'm assuming that they feed the columns in a way that pretty much everybody's paper gets the same column on the same day. I may be wrong, but I'm assuming that that's the case. And so probably in your local paper, if it has Ann Landers' column, or what's now called Annie's Mailbox, you will see this article. This was the top one. Dear Annie, as a faithful reader of your column, I'm hoping you can help me get the word out about something. I have to deal with something that I have to deal with almost every day. I am a 49-year-old male married to a 37-year-old woman. It's my second marriage and her first. My wife and I are expecting a child this May. What's my problem, you ask? It is the misconceptions that people seem to carry around with them. You see, my wife is black and I am white. He writes this fellow into Dear Ann. Dear Ann. Sometimes when people are introduced to my wife for the first time, you can see that they are taken aback. I have even received scowls from people I don't know when they see my wife and me holding hands in public. It's the 21st century, people! he writes. Interracial marriages are happening every day. Stop assuming that because a person is white, black, purple, or green, that their spouses are of the same pigmentation. He says, when I look at my wife, I don't see her skin color. I see the woman whom I dearly love and who is carrying my child. That's what other people should see, too. Thanks for letting me vent. I'm grateful in Illinois. And the response, of course, from Dear Annie. This is from Kathy and Marcy, actually. Thank you for bringing enlightenment to those who need it and demonstrating that love knows no color. So here, this is the progress that we've made. I mean, in the early 1960s, as I recall, it might have been 54. I'm sure it was 64. In the early 1960s, it was illegal in many states for people of different races to marry. Illegal. You can go back a few hundred years before that, or maybe 500 years before the Middle Ages of Europe. It was illegal for anybody to marry unless they were the nobility. I mean, you know, the serfs didn't enjoy, they didn't own anything. They didn't have the right, they didn't have legal rights, any legal right of marriage. Marriage has gone through a lot of transitions. Which brings us, now where is he going with this? Which brings us to our conservative alert for the day. The first thing on the education secretary's, our new education secretary, Margaret Spellman, the first thing on her plate today was to attack PBS. What for? To attack PBS for a cartoon character who had the audacity of coming here to the People's Republic of Vermont and doing a show on maple sugaring. Yes, maple sugaring. That just happened to be done by a family with two mommies. The new Secretary of Education says, Terry McAuliffe, here, Democratic chairman, DNC chairman Terry McAuliffe, the new Secretary of Education is confined to a very narrow and selfish agenda if her first action in office is to threaten an American institution like PBS. While America's schools are crumbling, our students are falling behind in basic skills, Republicans in Washington are too busy pursuing an intolerant agenda to try and solve the real problem. Is the administration carving discrimination back into the Constitution? Has it become the Santorum wing of the party? Are the haters taking over not just the Republican Party, but America? Margaret Spelling, this is incredible. She says, many parents would not want their young children exposed to the lifestyles portrayed in the episode. She's talking about this program, this PBS special. It's called Postcards from Buster. Now, this is the top story in our Vermont paper here. It's at the top of the front page. Why? Because these two families, there's a big color picture here of these four women with six kids in front of these two families. Two couples who have been civil unioned here in Vermont. Lily Herrett, well, they go through all the names. I don't need to read you all the names. And they are furious. They're saying, you know, let me just tell you this, what it is. Vermont Public Television decided Wednesday, this is in this story by John Briggs, Free Press staff writer, this is Burlington Free Press. Vermont Public Television decided Wednesday to air the Vermont episode of Postcards from Buster, despite the PBS decision to pull it nationally. In the series, Buster, an animated rabbit, visits children around the country with his airline pilot father. This is a story about a kid, only he's a rabbit, that's designed for other kids, and sends video postcards back to his friends. In more than 40 episodes of the series, Buster has visited 24 states and met 45 families from different backgrounds. Divorced, conventionally married, a Greek Orthodox family in Chicago, fundamentalist Christian family, a Muslim family, Jewish, inner city, a farm family, a Mormon family in Utah, children living with grandparents, and in one episode, five children sharing a trailer bedroom in Virginia. Now that didn't bother Margaret Spellman. Poverty. Hopkins, the person who put the series together, says, we reflect the diversity and the rich culture of American kids. The Vermont episode shows maple sugaring and the Shelburne Museum and features the children of two same-sex parent families. In each case, Hopkins said of the series, the family comes into this. The parents, however, are not the feature. They're in the background. A Vermont congressman, Bill Lippert of Hinesburg, he's in the Vermont Congress, not the United States Congress. He was the vice chairman of the House Judiciary Committee when the Civil Unions Bill raged this back 5 years ago, when the state was just ripped apart by this thing. More or less. I mean, we've survived it, right? Louise and I have been married, what, 32 years, I think, now? And it didn't happen, right? I mean, they said, you know, when they pass that civil unions bill, all the married people are going to get divorced. It didn't happen. I'm sorry. I'm still married. Rama's still married to Grace. What can you say? I'm sorry. We haven't seen an epidemic of divorce here in Vermont. What we have seen is that gay couples can now have hospital visitation rights and inheritance rights. This is not a family value. It's outrageous, says Congressman Bill Lippert. It's outrageous that PBS is responding to this kind of homophobic pressure. To call it a sensitive issue is another way of saying gay people and their families don't merit the same respect as other families. That's part of the problem, he says, in our society today. Our families aren't a threat to anyone, he said. This member of Congress is himself gay. A spokesman for Lambda Legal, which is a national organization established to protect gay and lesbian rights, said, this is bullying by anti-gay forces. We're concerned that the Bush administration actions here have led to censorship. To censorship. I'm telling you, the haters are taking over the Republican Party. And they're doing it because there are enough fearful people out here in America who are fearful about genuine things, like they might lose their job because of conservative economic policies, the Bush doctrine that exporting jobs overseas is just a fine thing. Bringing illegal aliens into the United States is just a fine thing. There was some Republican on TV yesterday. I just kind of walked through it and caught it, and he was going, well, if they want to export all these aliens, what are they going to tell the house building industry? How about telling them to do what they were doing when I was a kid? Hire local folks and pay them a decent wage. You know, your CEO might not be able to make a $5 million salary this year. He might only make a $3 million salary if you have to pay $7 an hour, $8 an hour, $10 an hour instead of $3 an hour to illegals. But suddenly, we'll have jobs in this country. Mexico will have to figure out they have to fix their own economy. Thank you very much. And my take on this is not the Michael Savage take of, oh, gee, they're dark skinned people, get them out. You know that. No. It's that a nation that we have a situation now where 1/10 of the population of Mexico is in the United States. It is not good for Mexico. It's not good for the United States. Republicans don't want to talk about that. They don't want to talk about the fact that millions of jobs a year are going to China. That we can't build missiles now without parts from China. China, the communist China. They don't want to talk about the fact that China holds us economically, shall we say, by... In a very delicate way, they have the ability to bring us to our knees. There's really nothing funny. And now here a coalition. This is the New York Times. David Kirkpatrick and Cheryl Gay Stolberg. A coalition of major conservative Christian groups is threatening to withhold support for President Bush's plans to remake Social Security unless Mr. Bush vigorously champions a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. See, I'm telling you, this is what has been going on, and it's the kind of the glue that has made the Republican Party viable, and it's going to lead to their undoing. And that is that at the core of the Republican Party you have the same, how to say it, at the core of the Republican Party, you have this group of folks who have largely, I would say, almost purely economic interests. Their interest is in promoting, you know, wealth, just largely and purely economic interest. Their interest is in promoting more wealth and more power over government for very, very large multinational corporations. The toadies and stooges of the of maybe 500 large, I mean, the 500 largest corporations in the world. That's at the core of the Republican Party. Promote the wealth agenda. But that's not big enough to bring everybody in. So they had to, in order to win elections, they had to bring in the anti-abortion folks, the anti-gay folks, ultimately even the anti-black folks. This was Nixon's Southern strategy. He said, hey, LBJ has abandoned the racists in the South, and LBJ did. When they came to LBJ and they said, you know, if you sign the civil rights legislation and you force integration in the South, the Democratic Party is going to lose the South for a generation. And LBJ said, if that's the price it takes to end segregation in the United States, it's a price I'm willing to pay. And the Democratic Party is still paying it. And Nixon came along and said, we'll take these people. Well, now it's extending. It's growing. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brusho, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews. What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey wrote, Dear Mr. Oric, ever since we purchased your 8-pound Oric XL vacuum, my wife has been in heaven. Recently, she panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The machine is as good as new. Try my 8-pound Oric XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good morning.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 24 minutes past the hour. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. TomHartman.com is our website. If you want to drop into the chat room, go visit our message board. Louise put up an interesting question today on the message board. She said, you know, if you have any questions that you'd like Tom to talk about in the air, specific issues. And within 10 minutes of posting the thing, I think she had two answers, you know, very thoughtful ones. It's just great being able to communicate with folks this way. But the telephone also works well. Therefore, we got John in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you, John?
I'm fine. Before I get to, I'd just like to make a statement. I think you are the best progressive voice on the radio. You have that speaking that makes sense even to conservatives. I don't see how anyone can get around you. I think you're wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Just wanted
you,
to get that out of the way. Now, this thing you were just talking about before, the whole immigration issue, it's a very, very sketchy issue. Neither side really tackles it head on because they both have constituents that kind of, they can't please everybody. Eric Alterman said once on the Air America, he's writing a book right now that called Arguments for Liberalism. He's working on it. And this issue is something that he has a hard time tackling, and I have a hard time understanding it in the sense that protecting jobs is one thing, but letting repetitive, low-paying jobs go isn't necessarily bad in the long run, but isn't necessarily good in the short run. And just wondering if you could elaborate on that, on ramifications long-term and short-term of how we go about protecting jobs that, if we keep them here, have such high pay that they're just not competitive on an open market. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like a catch-22 to me. It's a very tough argument. I don't understand.
Well, here's the situation. Here's what's happened, John, is that the rules of the game have changed over in the 30 years or more that I've been in the workforce. I mean, my first job, I think I was 15, working at Henry's Hamburgers, flipping burgers for whatever it was back then, 50 cents an hour or something, a buck an hour. And there used to be, you know, basically entry level jobs. And then you get your high school diploma and you could, you know, get a basic union job working at Oldsmobile or something like that. Or you go on and get a degree from college and get into the professions. And what has happened and the reason why we had those union jobs was because we were protecting our manufacturing industries. We were saying, you know, yes, you can make shirts more cheaply in Thailand than you can here. It's been that way for 200 years. But if you make them in Thailand and import them into the United States, you have to pay a tax on it. And we did that to protect American jobs, pure and simple. I mean, when the first protective tariff was passed in 1787, this was the same year the Constitution was ratified. The first protective tariff was passed, and the title of the bill was a tariff for the protection of domestic industries. It was to protect American jobs. And we had that continuously in the United States, and it went up and down, and it varied all over the place. And, you know, Smoot-Hawley was an attempt, for example, in 1930 to increase it. Herbert Hoover did, to increase protectionism. But there have been variations. But basically, we had that in the United States right up until about 20 years ago, more or less. And Reagan started dismantling this. And part of it goes back to the fast-track thing that Nixon was pushing for like crazy, and finally, you know, Bush Sr., which is where you could declare a nation most favored nation and just kind of basically do away with tariffs just between two countries. And we have that now with China. But really, Bill Clinton kicked the door open with NAFTA and GATT. And you have a situation now where You can't, these jobs don't exist in the United States anymore because of this so-called free market. Well, it's not free and it's not fair. What it is a market that benefits only big multinational corporations. And I think that there is an appropriate place, John, for a healthy form of nationalism. That is to say, this is our country. We're going to make the decisions that are going to be best for our country. Not in ways that are destructive to other countries, but are explicitly best for our country. And every country needs to be doing that same thing. And communities need to do the same thing. Communities should have the right to say no to a Walmart because it's destructive to the community, for example.
I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, and I'll get into the immigration thing right after the break and just give you the answer on, you know, why not have immigrants come in and fill our cheap jobs? Well, the bottom line really is we need entry-level jobs, and you know, there's nothing wrong with that. And there are a lot of Americans who would love to have, you know, relatively low-paying jobs, and, you know, especially in construction. Anyhow, John, I'll continue this after the break. Thanks for the call.
Love guides.
My daughter has a million things going on in her daily life, from softball to band to voice lessons. My husband and I like to make sure she doesn't spend her idle time idle, because an idle mind is a playground for trouble. You see, occupying our daughter's free time and keeping her active makes us feel confident that she won't be hanging out with the wrong crowds.
Love, the anti-drug. Call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com for information on how to prevent your child from using marijuana.
Paid for by ONDCP.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO is launching a national grassroots fight to defend Social Security against the Bush privatization attempt. Actions in San Francisco and in Boston on Wednesday singled out financial firms like Charles Schwab, urging them not to assist Social Security privatization. Tim Paulson is the executive director of the San Francisco Labor Council.
Social Security is not broken. The only thing that's attempted to be broken is the promise to working men and women that when they retire that they will have guaranteed benefits. And we believe that corporate America is just drooling right now, waiting to get a piece of our retirement and to make sure that they can get profit off of it and to let it get into the speculative realm.
The AFL-CIO believes that private financial companies rocked by corporate crime and scandal in recent years should never be trusted to handle Social Security accounts. These rallies are only the opening rounds in labor's battle to defend Social Security.
Trade unions in Africa's last true monarchy are entering a second day of strikes aimed at democratic reforms. Swaziland has begun drafting a constitution that the Federation of Trade Unions says will give the monarchy more power. King Mswati III has been criticized of living a rich lifestyle while most of the country's population lives in poverty. More than a third of Swazis are HIV positive. The union is seeking a constitution that will include separation of power between branches of government, as well as a respect for women and human rights. In Boston, a civil suit against a union that represents uniformed officers with the rank of sergeant or higher began this week. The suit was filed 3 years ago by Karen Kelly, a former bookkeeper for the Boston Superior Officers Federation. She claims in the suit that the union allowed its former vice president, Thomas W. Nolan, to sexually harass her. Kelly says between September 1999 and December 2000, Nolan repeatedly called her indecent pet names and sent her emails and left phone messages asking for sexual favors. The lawsuit alleges that when Kelly refused Nolan, her pay was cut, work conditions changed, and her workload increased. According to the Boston Globe, Federation President Joseph Gillespie says Kelly wasn't harassed and her pay was cut as a cost-saving measure. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The Multinational Monitor has released its top 10 worst companies of 2004. Topping the list, Abbott Laboratories. According to the Monitor, at the end of 2003, Abbott raised the price of its life-or-death anti-AIDS drug, Norvir, by 400%. The company claims that the increase was to cover research and development. The stipulation, the price increase does not apply if purchased along with another Abbott drug. Critics say that gives Abbott an unfair market advantage and forces users to only use their drugs.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This
is the Tom Hartman Program.
So here's how it works, just to wrap up the answer to John's question. In a healthy economy, in a reasonable healthy economy, you have several, multiple, say, let's say, levels of jobs. There are entry-level jobs that people get into when they're going to school, for example, work their way through college kind of thing. You know, the young, whatever, or for people who are at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, right? For better or for worse. Obviously, you want to provide as much social mobility as you can. And there are always going to be some folks who are just, you know, just getting by. Then you have jobs that are suited for, let's say, the masses, as it were, for the large majority of the middle class. And that traditionally in the United States has taken one of two forms. For the first 100 years or so of this country, it was agriculture, family farms. For the last 100 years or so of this country, it's been manufacturing. And in both cases, we've protected those. We protected family farms by having tariffs on imported agricultural goods, and we protected manufacturing by having tariffs on manufactured goods, taxes on imports. And then, of course, you know, at the high end, you've got the professions, you know, becoming a doctor or lawyer or whatever, those kinds of things. And there, in a healthy economy, there's a lot of mobility between these. That is, you provide those people who are motivated to do so, you provide them with an opportunity to make that transition from one of those categories into another without a great deal of difficulty. Jefferson's idea to do this was to have free college education for everyone in the United States. That's why he started the University of Virginia. He felt that was more important than his having been president of the United States. It's why on his tombstone, which he dictated, does not say, "Here lies Thomas Jefferson, president of the United States." It says it lists three things he did, and one of them is president of the University of Virginia, or founder of the University of Virginia, which was free. Keep in mind, college in California, university in California, all the way up to your PhD, totally free, till Ronald Reagan came along and said, "What? This is socialism," and ended it. That free university system, or very inexpensive university system. My mother, during the Great Depression, went to the Michigan State University, got her bachelor's degree in English. That she was not wealthy. It was possible because it was a land-grant college. There were these enormous subsidies from the state to allow people to. My father went to college on the GI Bill. We have found ways throughout the years to make it possible for there to be social mobility. Well, the conservatives are reversing that. Our society is now probably more rigid than it has been since the pre-1930s, since the Gilded Age. And this is what the cons are taking us back to. So, number one, a healthy economy would have all these transition points. And so you wouldn't have a permanent underclass, except for that very small number of people who really are just content to, you know, wash dishes their whole life, and that's really all they want. That's the top of their aspirations. But you wouldn't have a large permanent underclass, and you wouldn't have the need for a lot of cheap labor coming in, you know, foreign cheap labor, illegal cheap labor. I mean, the bottom line here, and see, there's really two issues. The bottom line here is the reason why I think a lot of liberals are uncomfortable with this is because there's a lot of folks, you know, the Michael Savages of the world who are screaming about immigration, and it's basically racial hatred motivation. I mean, they're you know, oh no, you know, the America's going to end up being a nation that's not majority white. Right? This is an argument, seriously, that's made very often on the extreme end, on the extreme fringes of the right. And you know, when they point to the demographics, and they're right. That, frankly, doesn't worry me. I don't, you know, I think, you know, regardless of the color of the skin of the majority of Americans, the ideals of America are real and will transmit from generation to generation. We are not a race-based nation. And in fact, I think if we ever go back to thinking of ourselves in those terms, it'll be a harmful thing. So, you know, there are those folks who argue against immigration. I argue against illegal immigration, not against all immigration, but against open borders and illegal immigration. in the context of I am arguing against those folks who are simply looking for cheap labor. They are simply looking to essentially replace the slaves that we gave up after the Civil War. Although, you know, the reality is, of course, that African Americans in the United States worked, and they were no longer slaves after the Civil War, but they worked for slave wages for a long life, and many continue to for a long, long time. But my concern is that we have a situation where industries that traditionally were well-paying, good-paying industries, when I was a teenager, anybody could get a job at Henry's Hamburgers back when they had Henry's Hamburgers, before McDonald's put them out of business. But to get a job building a house, that was tough, and it paid well. And, you know, and yesterday you got this Republican on TV saying, well, you don't want to have all these immigrants in the country. Tell that to the home building industry. You'll put them out of business. No, you won't put them out of business. You'll raise the price of homes somewhat. And guess what? You'll have a whole lot more people who are making more money so they can afford it. People say, well, you know, if we put tariffs on goods coming in from China, it's going to cost more at Walmart. Yes, it's going to cost more at Walmart. Would you rather have stuff always cost less at Walmart and always have your paycheck going down, down, down? Or would you rather have stuff at Walmart go up 5% in price and have your paycheck go up 20% in price? Because labor is not the only cost of the products. Labor is only a small percentage of the cost of the product. So if labor costs increase, the product costs don't increase as much as labor cost does, and your middle class grows. And that's what we saw in the United States for 200 years, and that's what's been being reversed since conservative economics became fashionable under Reagan for the first time since the Gilded Age, when we had huge, explosive, massive, widespread poverty. And I have digressed substantially from the topic of the haters in the Republican Party. I did want to get into this. Newt Gingrich, he says the hot topic of the 2008 race, it's going to be under God. All right, they have to have wedge issues, because if they told the truth about what they're really up to, which is the economic stuff, that's what the Republicans, that's what the conservatives are really up to. If they told the truth about that, America would desert them in droves, as we did in the 30s and 40s and 50s. By the way, not only did Newt leave wife number one when she became ill, he also dumped wife number two when she became ill. He ended his first marriage when his wife had cancer. He divorced his second wife when she was diagnosed with MS, or a neurological disorder that at the time they thought was MS. Yeah. The family values of the right. See, that this is it. They got to talk. They got to talk the talk. They're not always up for walking the walk. Let's go back to the phones here. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Jeremy in State College, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Tom, you just put about four or five different things in my mind listening to you there on hold. But anyway,
sorry about that.
Education and media, I can talk about both because I am a Penn State student, actually a full-time employee of the university as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a substantial discount being a full-time employee, being able to go to school there. And I'll tell you straight up, if I didn't have that, I couldn't go.
Yeah, and that's wrong. We should have, as the majority of all of the Western European countries, as far as I know, have, we should have free college education. It is the thing that ensures social mobility, and social mobility is the thing that ensures domestic tranquility and makes democracies work.
Right. But anyway, I am a media studies student, so tying it into what you're talking about, how the Republicans have taken over, I recommend anyone read David Brock's newest book, The Republican Noise Machine.
Yeah.
He lays out in the first four chapters very succinctly how the liberal media myth started. It's based on no fact, and they just created things like the Heritage Foundation to be credible think tanks when actually they're propaganda mills where they are able to push their quote-unquote experts onto cable television, and the vast majority of people in this country get their information from television.
Yeah, it started out with a bunch of cranky, rich white guys, Joe Coors and Richard Mellon-Scaife and whatnot.
Right. And he mentions also Edith Efron with her book, The News Twisters, and how they took legitimate complaints about Watergate and Nixon and turned it into an attack on Nixon.
Right.
And the liberal media myth has now been created, but I think the important thing is I hear a lot of liberals now saying, well, what do we do, what do we do, what do we do? I think there needs to be a concerted effort ethically to build liberal think tanks that do the same thing the right wing does and get those experts
get the message on television
as well to create.
Well, that's happening. You know, George Soros has funded much of that, including David Brock's new group called the Media Matters, MediaMatters.org,
right.
and the Center for American Progress, John Podesta's group. And they're doing great work. I'm on their email lists, and I get all their stuff. I get all the right wing stuff, too. And they are doing really, really good work. And then there are a number. What's really surprising, what's really impressive, really, are the number of progressive websites that are aggregating information, and in many cases putting forward original thinking, that are running on an absolute shoestring. I mean, just an absolute shoestring. CommonDreams.org, BuzzFlash.com, OpEdNews.com, TakeBackTheMedia.com. MakeThemAccountable.com. I mean, there's just a bunch of them. We have them on here on Friday afternoons on our Best of the Rest of the News segment. And they're doing great work. And it's a grassroots thing. And I think it's just marvelous.
That's important.
Jeremy, thanks for the call and thanks for raising that and pointing out. David Brock's first book, by the way, Blinded by the Right, is also brilliant. I have tremendous respect for David Brock. I hope his ears are ringing or itching or burning or whatever it is right now, because he's a guy you need to read. Craig in Charlottesville, Virginia, on the line. Hey, Craig, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. I when I was growing up as a kid back in the 50s, I thought it was pretty rigid back then, but that's nothing to compare to what's going on now.
Oh, yeah.
I worked at Monticello for about 7 years, and I, you know, being around all the scholarly people that work up there, you absorb a lot of stuff, and it just seems to me like what the Bush administration is putting out as far as policy and direction is so far removed from what Jefferson believed and the founding fathers believed. It's sickening.
We are moving in, and I say this not to be inflammatory or outrageous, but in purely in the dictionary sense of the word, we are moving in the direction of fascism in the United
Absolutely.
States.
Absolutely, and I think the day is coming when the Republicans in office are going to start deriding the founding fathers.
Oh, it's already there. It's already here. I mean, you wanted a great example. These are not Republicans in office, but yeah, we're rewriting history.
Mm-hmm.
McCullough's book on John Adams, which was such a big hit, you know, a couple of years ago, that the Republicans were talking about building a statue for John Adams. John Adams, the guy who pushed through the Alien Sedition Acts, the first president of the United States, the second president of the United States, the first one in history to put into prison newspaper editors because they wrote editorials that he didn't like.
Yeah.
And he, 20 of them, he put them in prison. He put Matthew Lyon, the congressman from Vermont, in prison for speaking out against the policies of the Federalists, back then. We're called the Federalists, what today you'd call the Republicans, on the floor of the House of Representatives. He got in a fight with Roger Griswold of Connecticut. He said to Griswold, the Federalist, was only defending the interests of the rich and the well-bred. Griswold comes after him with a cane. John Adams throws Matthew Lyon in prison, sends him up here to Vermont, to Vergennes, Vermont. He spends the whole winter in an unheated jail cell while he's still a member of the United States Congress. He runs for re-election in the election of 1798, and he wins.
Oh, Lord.
He wins.
Well,
and Thomas Jefferson had to let him out in 1800 when he finally won. I mean, this, and these guys, and they write, and McCullough writes this book, Elevating Adams to Sainthood, and the last third of the book is trashing Jefferson.
I'm sorry to tell you, Tom, but I am of the same bloodline as John Adams.
Yeah, well, that's fine. I mean, John Adams wasn't, John Adams had a lot of good things,
you
know, going on, too. I don't totally knock him. In fact, I occasionally quote him, but he had a fascist streak in him. And,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
His son was actually a little better president,
I
think.
Was in regards to a topic that Rama was discussing yesterday when he so aptly did your substituting for you.
Yeah, I didn't hear it. They were drilling my teeth, so.
You can't hear too well during that.
No.
But he was talking about how some of the Democratic senators were voting for confirmation for Condoleezza because they felt the president should have the advisors of his choosing.
Yeah.
And it just, maybe I'm wrong about that, but didn't they put the provision in the Constitution for Senate approval of those nominees?
Yes, it's called advice and consent.
People like Condoleezza out?
Yeah, it says the Senate has the obligation to advise and consent on presidential nominations. And consent is a very significant word. It means agree.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean bow down. It means agree.
Right.
And
another point, some of them were talking about saving their ammunition for bigger fights like Supreme Court nominees.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know
what
they're talking about. Ammunition, they've got to vote for each of those.
I know. It's absolutely silly.
Votes.
I know. It's not a fungible quantity.
The thing that they hammered Kerry for, flip-flopping, Isn't that what they'd be doing if they do that? They
yeah.
should be consistent with their votes.
No, the Democrats in Congress have to get some spine. That's just the bottom line. Craig, thanks for the call. I got to move along. I appreciate it though. Brian in Houston, Texas, on the line. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Yeah, I was listening to what you were talking about. Going from the hamburger shop to the union job. You kind of describe my life. You know, it's like coming up in Michigan. The General Motors jobs were all union jobs. We went to high school. They got union jobs.
Yeah, half my friends. I grew up in Lansing. Half my friends' parents worked. Dads worked at Oldsmobile. A couple of them, their mothers. Yeah.
And what now that I'm older, what I realize is that those companies, union jobs, they paid well, provided good health care, and the city was better for it.
Right. And one other thing, if I could just interrupt you, Brian, and one other thing, the profits were kept here in the United States. I saw an ad on TV yesterday for one of the Japanese auto manufacturers, and they were saying, we employ people in Texas, we employ people in Virginia, we employ people in Tennessee. Like, aren't we wonderful? What they didn't mention is, and we take all the profits back to Japan.
Exactly.
Excuse me.
But when we worked there, the first thing we did, when we got our year in or whatever, we went out and bought a brand new General Motors car.
There you go.
You got married, you had kids, you took them to the doctors. Everybody did well because the workers made a good
That's
living.
Right. That's right. A rising tide lifts all ships, but it has to be from the bottom up, not from the top down. It's what the cons are talking about is trickling down, not raising the tide. Thanks for the call, Brian. I do appreciate it. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
Bonjour. My name is Veronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
People tend to adopt symbols of the places where they live. But what happens when those symbols disappear? I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Most people remember favorite landmarks from early in their lives. They range from prominent features to small patches where they played as children. Howard Mansfield says these places represent what he calls our axis mundi, or center of the world.
Throughout our landscapes, there are magnificent trees, there are churches, there are rock things that we name that become landmarks to us. And that's our connection to place. And as we pave the world over, we overturn this axis mundi, we overturn these central places, and that's part of the disquiet people feel.
Mansfield is the author of a new book, The Bones of the Earth. He says our landmarks can be small and personal or large and public, like New Hampshire's Old Man of the Mountain. This rock feature, which resembled a human profile, crumbled away in 2003.
People were so upset. They said, that's my life that fell down. I saw the old man first thing in the summer. I saw him last thing going home. I said hello to him all the time. And the other thing that upset people was, wait a minute, stone is supposed to be eternal. But stone, too, is a ticking clock. Again, you get that idea of change. Everything is changing.
Mansfield says our connection to landmarks makes them worth fighting for.
Just because it's an emotional or an intuitive sense of place doesn't mean that it has no value and that it has to immediately fall to somebody's plan to bulldoze a pasture or widen a road, because that does not necessarily have the right of way. It's the other thing. It's the sense of place that is more important that should win the day.
That's Howard Mansfield, author of The Bones of the Earth. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes.
Well, maybe it has to do with the Republicans in Congress. And a lot of the Democrats as well. I am an equal opportunity critic, I suppose, and praiser. Occasionally a Republican will come along and say something really good and really important, and I will acknowledge them for it. And occasionally, more often, the Democrats do. Certainly the Greens do almost, you know, absolutely consistently. Anyhow, back to the telephones. Mike in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Mike, what's up today?
Not much. Cold and clear. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, nothing new here.
Okay.
I wanted to tie together two of the questions over the that have come out in the last hour.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is, you were saying, well, you know, the Republicans are hateful and so forth. Problem of it is, most of the nation has, because we have become dumbed down, simplified, simple.
Well, it's partly that, and this was the point that I started to make, Mike, and I don't think I really did it justice. There are a lot of people in America who are justifiably terrified about a whole bunch of things. Losing their job, not having health care, what kind of retirement are they going to have? Is the nation going down the tubes? Are we going to have a depression? You know, blah-de-blah-de-blah. Is my kid going to go to Iraq? They're justifiably concerned. That turns into a generalized anxiety. My dentist yesterday was saying that she's seen now 10% of her patients are grinding their teeth. She said that 20 years ago when she started in dentistry, it was like 1%. It was rare. She said, we've got an epidemic of anxiety disorders in the United States right now. There's a dentist telling me this, right? And it's true. And so what the Republicans do is they come along and they say, you know, you're right to be afraid, and here's who you need to blame it on. Blame it on the gay people. Blame it on the black people. Blame it on the immigrants. Blame it on... And it's the blame game to divert attention away from what's really going on, which is conservative economic policies destroying the core of this country.
Oh, and the second point I wanted to bring up?
Yeah.
You always bring up Adams and the Alien Sedition Act,
yeah,
which is a good point. However, you also need to point out that the Democrats are no better. Under Wilson, we had the Sedition Act reenacted.
Wilson did the same thing. Absolutely. Woodrow Wilson did absolutely the same thing, and he deserves just as much criticism as John Adams. I totally agree with you, and I appreciate the call. Let me move along. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky. We just have about a half a minute left here. What's up, Dennis?
Okay, real quick. I'm an American of African descent, mostly African descent, and I left the Democratic Party, and I think you guys are, you know, he's been playing to black people. I think Condi Rice.
You guys, I'm not a Democrat. I'm sorry, so I'm not part of the you guys. Though.
Well, I'm saying Condoleezza Rice is just a messenger, and she didn't make the policy. She was no more wrong than Barbara Boxer was in 1998 when she supported Clinton's.
Interesting point, Dennis. We're out of time. Interesting point you make. I hope you can call back in. You know, later on in the week or next week, and we can talk about this in more detail. I do appreciate it. It's Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con in conservative.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO is launching a national grassroots fight to defend Social Security against the Bush privatization attempt. Actions in San Francisco and in Boston on Wednesday singled out financial firms like Charles Schwab, urging them not to assist Social Security privatization. Tim Paulson is the executive director of the San Francisco Labor Council.
Social Security is not broken. The only thing that's attempted to be broken is the promise to working men and women that when they retire that they will have guaranteed benefits. And we believe that corporate America is just drooling right now, waiting to get a piece of our retirement and to make sure that they can get profit off of it and to let it get into the speculative realm.
The AFL-CIO believes that private financial companies rocked by corporate crime and scandal in recent years should never be trusted to handle Social Security accounts. These rallies are only the opening rounds in labor's battle to defend Social Security.
Trade unions in Africa's last true monarchy are entering a second day of strikes aimed at democratic reforms. Swaziland has begun drafting a constitution that the Federation of Trade Unions says will give the monarchy more power. King Mswati III has been criticized of living a rich lifestyle while most of the country's population lives in poverty. More than a third of Swazis are HIV positive. The union is seeking a constitution that will include separation of power between branches of government, as well as a respect for women and human rights. In Boston, a civil suit against a union that represents uniformed officers with the rank of sergeant or higher began this week. The suit was filed 3 years ago by Karen Kelly, a former bookkeeper for the Boston Superior Officers Federation. She claims in the suit that the union allowed its former vice president, Thomas W. Nolan, to sexually harass her. Kelly says between September 1999 and December 2000, Nolan repeatedly called her indecent pet names and sent her emails and left phone messages asking for sexual favors. The lawsuit alleges that when Kelly refused Nolan, her pay was cut, work conditions changed, and her workload increased. According to the Boston Globe, Federation President Joseph Gillespie says Kelly wasn't harassed and her pay was cut as a cost-saving measure. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The Multinational Monitor has released its top 10 worst companies of 2004. Topping the list, Abbott Laboratories. According to the Monitor, at the end of 2003, Abbott raised the price of its life-or-death anti-AIDS drug, Norvir, by 400%. The company claims that the increase was to cover research and development. The stipulation, the price increase does not apply if purchased along with another Abbott drug. Critics say that gives Abbott an unfair market advantage and forces users to only use their drugs.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Are you tired of progressives spending all their energy on defensive struggles where a victory simply maintains the status quo? We are too, and we're doing something about it. At ReclaimDemocracy.org, we're taking the initiative to revoke corporate power and restore citizen authority over corporations to enable genuine progress on the many issues that we all care about. Get involved. Visit us online at ReclaimDemocracy.org or call 406-582-1224.
At George W.'s recent National Economic Conference, an entire session was devoted to bashing trial lawyers. And what a rollicking good time it was. A panel of corporate interests wowed the hand-picked audience of Bush partisans with jabs at the lawyers who try to hold wrongdoing corporations accountable to those of us who are harmed. George himself nodded and chuckled as panelists cried about people who sue these business empires. For example, Home Depot CEO Bob Nardelli, a Fat Cat Bush donor, was there, wailing that his $64 billion a year retailing Goliath is a target for pesky consumers and their lawyers. "You've got deep pockets colliding with shallow principles," Bob snorted, drawing guffaws from an appreciative George who is demanding that Congress limit the rights of consumers to bring lawsuits against the Home Depots. Missing from Bush's Bash Fest was Mary Penturf. Even if invited, though, she wouldn't have come since, well, she's dead. Her head was crushed by a 75-pound box that fell from one of Home Depot's high-stack shelves. Nor could Janessa Horner be there to testify. This 3-year-old's body was shattered by wood fragments when more than a ton of kitchen countertops fell 10 feet from a Home Depot forklift, splitting a main blood vessel in Janessa's brain. She died 4 hours later. Nardelli tries to keep secret the number of people killed or maimed by Home Depot, which has been labeled the most dangerous store in America. But it's known that in 1 year alone, they were getting 185 injury claims per week. Why doesn't Bob do something about it? Because it's more profitable for him to settle with the families than to change the dangerous way his stores operate. This is Jim Hightower saying, and it's even more profitable for him to back his buddy Bush, who will then push a law to keep families like Mary Penturf's and Janessa Horner's from suing Home Depot for their loss, pain, and suffering.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac. The libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what. Support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Our Tools for Activism course, by the way, we're going to put on hold for a couple of weeks. We've got a lot of travel coming up, and I want to really polish this thing and fine-tune it. We're going to roll it back out again a few weeks down the road. So that's on hold. It is the second hour of our Thursday program, however, and that's when in the first few minutes here of our second hour every Thursday, we usually go a little beyond the politics and topical issues of the day and, you know, what's in the news and that sort of thing into things that maybe you didn't know that you needed to know about. Maybe you didn't know that you didn't know. Maybe you didn't know that you didn't know that you needed to know what you didn't know. But you do need to know. In fact, maybe even everything that you do know that you think you know is not right. In fact, maybe
you know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be
Richard Heinberg is the author of a book called Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
It's good to be speaking with you, Tom.
It's I'm pleased to have you here. I really loved this book. I thought the little box on who are the neocons was great. I thought the political stuff that is in your book, which is really basically a book on the end of carbon, the end of the fossil fuel age, is you've pulled it together in ways that most of the other books of this type don't, and I think it's just marvelous. I'm very impressed with your writing. You should have asked me for a blurb. I love it.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad to be speaking with you because I've appreciated your work for several years too. So
well, thank you. We can create a mutual admiration society here.
Definitely.
You have in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which was sort of on the same topic, the end of oil.
Yeah.
I talked about older cultures and younger cultures and the cultural stuff. You've invented a few words here too. In this book, why don't you recap them for us? They have to do, my take on what they have to do is what the options are that a society faces when it's organizing itself in the face of energy supplies and well, I don't want to put words in your mouth. What are these definitions here? Power down is one of them.
Yeah, well, the path that I think we're on right now is what I call last one standing. People and other creatures as well tend to compete when resources become scarce. And we've seen that all through the 20th century. We've had oil war after oil war. World War I, in some ways, was an oil war. Great Britain was trying to keep Germany from developing further as an industrial power. And actually, Germany was trying to build the Berlin to Baghdad railway. And that was one of the factors that led up to World War I. World War II, of course, was an oil war. Japan was industrializing. The U.S. cut off oil shipments.
Yeah, we embargoed the Straits of Malacca. Right.
So, as we pass the global peak in oil production, which is likely to occur probably just within the next 2 or 3 years.
If it hasn't already.
Yeah, if it hasn't already, the most likely outcome will be resource wars. And given the kinds of armaments that we have today, and given the increasing tensions between the U.S. and the world's second foremost oil importing nation, which is China, China now is looking for long-term oil contracts in places like West Africa and Venezuela, Canada. China's even now trying to buy an American oil company, Unocal.
Right.
Given all of that, given events in the Middle East, we could be looking at, according to some people, we've already had World War III, which is the Cold War. This would be World War IV, I guess, by that definition. And it could be horrific indeed.
Well, here's the larger question then. Are we facing the collapse of society? And if so, when?
Well, yeah, actually, the number one book on the New York Times bestseller list right now is a book called Collapse by Jared Diamond.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at the collapse of previous civilizations, and he implies that something like that may be in store for us today. Unfortunately, Diamond, in his book, doesn't mention global oil peak anywhere. And as a result, I think he actually underestimates the likelihood.
Dramatically.
Dramatically. This is on the brink of collapse.
Yeah, this is what's driving the whole thing. I mean, this is what Cheney knows about. Okay, so you've talked about last man standing, or last one standing, and the power down. And there was I don't have it right in front of me. There was another phrase that you had used as another strategy. It was the cooperative strategy.
Yeah, well, waiting for the magic elixir.
There you go.
False hopes, wishful thinking, and denial is also a course that many of us are on. Those of us who think that just a little tweaking of the economic system or maybe a new energy source like hydrogen fuel cell cars or something like that will
cold fusion.
Make all the difference.
Cold fusion is going to solve all our problems.
Right. I call that business as usual light.
There you go.
I think I call that wishful thinking and false hopes because all that does is prevent us really from looking at the core of the problem, which is that we are in a growth economy, and we've created an economy that doesn't just believe in growth. It requires growth for its continued existence. And you can't continue to grow forever in a finite system, and unfortunately the Earth is a finite system. So push is going to come to shove very soon, not just with regard to oil, but also with regard to fresh water, topsoil, fish in the ocean, a whole laundry list.
Yeah, we have held up
and materials.
Exactly. We have held up growth as a high value. And in fact, let me just share with you a very short ad that Adbusters put together, the Adbusters group, about the problem that our economists haven't figured out, that growth isn't necessarily always a good thing.
For years, economists have defined the economic health of a country by its gross domestic product. Trouble is, every time a forest falls, the GDP goes up. With every oil spill, the GDP goes up. Every time a cancer patient is diagnosed, the GDP goes up. Is this how we measure economic progress? Economists must learn to subtract.
There you go. Economists must learn to subtract. And you're suggesting in your book that we need to learn to slow down. We need to decrease our consumption. We need to get into not even a sustainable mode. You're suggesting that we have to go into, in terms of consumption of resources, at least a downward trajectory, probably for a generation or more, to reach a point of homeostasis.
You could call this economic contraction rather than economic growth. Nobody wants to contemplate this. But the alternative is simply crash and chaotic collapse.
Yeah, which I don't think anybody wants. We're talking with Richard Heinberg. His book is called Power Down. Richard, we have a caller here, Pete in New York. Put him on the line here with you. Hey, Pete, you had a question for Richard?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Hey, Richard. Question for you. Read from some marijuana reform advocates that the growth of hemp not only provides a good source of paper, but could even be used to supply fuel up to 90%, I've heard the estimates, within the United States. I was wondering what your opinion was on that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a totally overblown estimate. I'm in favor of biofuels as a stopgap measure, but the energy profit ratio from biofuels is very low. You know, it takes energy to get energy. It takes energy to drill an oil well. It takes energy to grow a crop. And with oil, the energy profit ratio historically has been astronomical, something like 100 to 200 to 1, and we've gotten used to that. We've built a whole society based on this incredibly cheap
energy. In other words, for one unit of energy to extract and transport that oil, we derive 200 units of energy from the oil.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
But with biofuels, we're looking at an energy profit ratio that may, in some cases, like with ethanol,
some
cases be negative.
Right.
In other words, it actually takes more energy to grow the stuff,
right,
and process it.
Which is why we subsidize it.
Then we'll get out of the ethanol. And even in the best instances with a hemp crop or something like that, the energy profit ratio is going to be very low. So we can't imagine... we cannot envision running the present fleet of 200 million autos on biofuels. It's just not going to happen.
Although in defense of the hemp folks, it is, I think, important to point out that hemp is probably one of the most efficient converters of sunlight into cellulose and other carbon-based products.
Yes.
Just because it grows so fast and it's very, very efficient at extracting sunlight. But that's not the solution to the problem. What, in your opinion, we have about 4 minutes here. What do we need to do?
Well, it's difficult to say in 4 minutes, but we have to reform our monetary system for one thing, because right now all of our money is loaned into existence at interest, which means that if we don't have economic growth, the whole system collapses. So we need a non-interest-based currency. Then we need to be redesigning our cities.
Which is, by the way, let me just interrupt you for a second. Non-interest-based currency systems are what are demanded in both the Old Testament of the Bible and the Quran. I find that fascinating. It's like,
for good reason.
Yeah, exactly. the early founders of these religions, the early tribal folks, they had this figured out. Okay, on to your next point.
Yeah, then we have to redesign our cities to minimize the need for transportation. Right now, most of our food is trucked into cities from hundreds and thousands of miles away. We need thousands of urban gardens in every city, and we need good public transportation so that we can minimize the use of automobiles. Now, these are not things that can be done overnight, But if we don't start doing them immediately, we are going to be in very, very deep difficulty.
You know, some of this stuff is stuff that during World War II we did overnight. I mean, the Victory Gardens.
Right.
I lived in Germany for a year back in the mid-'80s, and we lived in a little town out in the middle of nowhere. And everybody's front yard was a vegetable garden. I mean, people grew about half their food right in their front yard.
Yeah, it's interesting that the Victory Garden movement actually was started by the people, not by the government.
Oh,
and in fact, the U.S. Department of Agriculture tried to suppress it because they thought that the Victory Gardens would compete with industrial agriculture. And when it became apparent that they couldn't suppress the movement, then they started taking credit for it.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. That's great. But these are the kinds of things that we can do and
absolutely.
We can start doing.
And, we have to emulate places like Havana, Cuba, where they've been doing with much less energy for the last 10 years as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And they've found ways to minimize transport, to move people out into the countryside, to participate in agriculture, and also to grow thousands of urban gardens. Those are the kinds of models we need to be looking to.
Yeah. Now, to some extent, the thousands of urban gardens and all those things, were those imposed on people, or was it just that people didn't have a lot of money, they didn't have a lot of food, so they started growing stuff in their front yard like they did in Germany?
Well, the urban gardens were encouraged by the state breaking up land and giving it to people to use for growing. Now, the folks moving to the countryside to work in agriculture, that in some cases that was imposed because the government understood that they needed more agricultural workers, given the fact that they didn't have the fuel to run the tractors with.
Yeah, and that's where it gets difficult. That's where it gets very difficult. It's like China dealing with their population problems. Richard Heinberg, the book Power Down raises a lot of questions, offers some great answers, options and actions for a post-carbon world. You can find it at the bookstore near you. Richard, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I do appreciate it. 20 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
This is Vivionik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartman Show, absolutely, without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
Love guides.
My daughter has a million things going on in her daily life, from softball to band to voice lessons. My husband and I like to make sure she doesn't spend her idle time idle, because an idle mind is a playground for trouble. You see, occupying our daughter's free time and keeping her active makes us feel confident that she won't be hanging out with the wrong crowds.
Love, the anti-drug. Call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com for information on how to prevent your child from using marijuana. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for a Drug-Free America.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. If you'd like to help bring the Tom Hartman program to a radio station in your area, please let us know. We have tools to help you make that happen. For more information, go to www.tomhartman.com and click on the Bring Tom Show to Your Town link on the left side of the page. Thanks for your help in bringing uncommon sense from the radical middle to your community.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly column, Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Cowboy Bob Slinger riding on the range. I'm white educated and I can't affect any change. Strange as it sounds.
And welcome back. China lost faith in the stability of the U.S. dollar. We'll get to that in a few minutes. First, we have Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, our daily report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey.
So has Gonzalez been confirmed yet?
Not as far as I know.
Okay.
It's going to happen.
Okay, yep.
It's going to happen, but it hasn't happened yet unless it's happened and I missed it.
Yeah. So what's going on there?
Well, it's one of those days where it's sort of the day after the day in a funny kind of a way, because we've had Condoleezza Rice confirmed. She took the helm on her seventh floor office. I don't know if you can take the helm at an office, but anyway, she did. And, of course, she's got the elections in Iraq, as we all have this weekend. So that's one of the main things. And people are also figuring out why President Bush gave the fairly major press conference that he did yesterday, what the point was of that. I mean, you know, it's rare for him to do it. There was no warning, and there we are. Suddenly it was there.
What was the point of it?
Don't know. I think part of it might have been, this is just me thinking, that he is starting to realize that the support for his Social Security plan is not as strong as he'd hoped. As you know, Democratic senators are going around responding to polls saying, no, they're not 100% in support of it, actually.
Yeah.
So one of the things that he said he's thinking of doing is going to take it on the road and get the word around that way, go direct to the voters. Of course, nobody knows what's in the plan, so it's difficult for most of us to decide whether we like it or not, because he won't tell us. But the thought was that this was a way of him starting that off, getting that out. Also, this helicopter had gone down in Iraq. I don't think that was the reason, because he, even though he said, you know, we mourn and we weep, he didn't sound like it was at the top of his agenda.
Well, it wasn't in his prepared remarks either. He didn't say anything about it until he was asked about it. So that
which was a little odd, actually.
Yeah, it was a lot odd, in my opinion.
Yeah, it was the biggest loss of life we've had. It was huge. And yet, even with that, you know, even though it did get coverage in the press, I don't think it actually got an awful lot of press coverage either, because it's becoming routine.
Yeah.
So for those families, it has to be pretty dreadful to realize that those deaths are now becoming routine. So those seem to be the reasons. Also, I think, you know, we do have his State of the Union address next week. He returned to some of his inaugural themes of liberty and freedom, and freedom and liberty, and liberty and freedom, and on and on and on. So I think it was sort of a trying to get everything out there. But again, why do it with 10 minutes' notice? Because it really was about 10 minutes' notice.
But he came in with prepared remarks, did he not?
He came in with prepared remarks, but they weren't quite perfunctory, but they almost were perfunctory.
Yeah.
It wasn't as though he came in and said, I'm having this press conference because.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a lot of speculation that, you know, his father was talking to reporters afterwards and saying, no, he's not trying to declare war on the world or all those parts of the world that don't have democracies. And no, he's not. We haven't, you know, this isn't a big change in policy. And yet Bush started out his press conference by saying it was a bold new step or a bold new initiative.
Well, and Condoleezza Rice said a similar thing today. She talked about President Bush's bold foreign policy.
Yeah.
I'm quite sure a lot of the careerists at the State Department are turning over and shuddering because the last thing that they want is bold foreign policy.
Right. Well, but they obviously Frank Luntz has been running his focus groups and they've been testing these words and
people
know,
like bold apparently.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah. It's
they like liberty and freedom.
Yeah, this is the
who doesn't?
This is the 365 day a year campaign strategy. I'm serious. They're priming people for the next Republican, for 2006, for the next elections, and for the Republicans in 2008, and trying to establish he wants to be thought of as a great president, and so he's got to rewrite history and cover up the fact that the most massive security failure in the history of the United States happened on his watch. That the person who was his national security advisor, who was responsible for protecting the nation, blew it, and he made her attorney general anyway. And, I mean, he's got to distract us from all that stuff, so.
Yes, he has. It's working less and less, and he's very conscious of his role in history. He's already started talking about that very early on in his second term.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Victoria, thanks for the report from Washington.
Thank you.
Always great to hear from you. Victoria
Thank
Jones
you.
With the Talk Radio News Service. 29 minutes past the hour. It's Tom Hartman here, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle.
Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey wrote, "Dear Mr. Oreck, ever since we purchased your 8-pound Oreck XL vacuum, my wife has been in heaven. Recently, she panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The machine is as good as new. Try my 8-pound Oreck XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO is launching a national grassroots fight to defend Social Security against the Bush privatization attempt. Actions in San Francisco and in Boston on Wednesday singled out financial firms like Charles Schwab, urging them not to assist Social Security privatization. Tim Paulson is the executive director of the San Francisco Labor Council.
Social Security is not broken. The only thing that's attempted to be broken is the promise to working men and women that when they retire that they will have guaranteed benefits. And we believe that corporate America is just drooling right now, waiting to get a piece of our retirement and to make sure that they can get profit off of it and to let it get into the speculative realm.
The AFL-CIO believes that private financial companies rocked by corporate crime and scandal in recent years should never be trusted to handle Social Security accounts. These rallies are only the opening rounds in labor's battle to defend Social Security.
Trade unions in Africa's last true monarchy are entering a second day of strikes aimed at democratic reforms. Swaziland has begun drafting a constitution that the Federation of Trade Unions says will give the monarchy more power. King Mswati III has been criticized of living a rich lifestyle while most of the country's population lives in poverty. More than a third of Swazis are HIV positive. The union is seeking a constitution that will include separation of power between branches of government, as well as a respect for women and human rights. In Boston, a civil suit against a union that represents uniformed officers with the rank of sergeant or higher began this week. The suit was filed 3 years ago by Karen Kelly, a former bookkeeper for the Boston Superior Officers Federation. She claims in the suit that the union allowed its former vice president, Thomas W. Nolan, to sexually harass her. Kelly says between September 1999 and December 2000, Nolan repeatedly called her indecent pet names and sent her emails and left phone messages asking for sexual favors. The lawsuit alleges that when Kelly refused Nolan, her pay was cut, work conditions changed, and her workload increased. According to the Boston Globe, Federation President Joseph Gillespie says Kelly wasn't harassed and her pay was cut as a cost-saving measure.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report.
The Multinational Monitor has released its top 10 worst companies of 2004. Topping the list, Abbott Laboratories. According to the Monitor, at the end of 2003, Abbott raised the price of its life-or-death anti-AIDS drug, Norvir, by 400%. The company claims that the increase was to cover research and development. The stipulation, the price increase does not apply if purchased along with another Abbott drug. Critics say that gives Abbott an unfair market advantage and forces users to only use their drugs.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Economists, China loses faith in the dollar. This is really scary stuff. This is from the Associated Press, article by Edith Lederer, AP press writer. From Davos, Switzerland, China has lost faith in the stability of the U.S. dollar, and its first priority is to broaden the exchange rate for its currency from the dollar to a more flexible basket of currency, a top Chinese economist said Wednesday at the World Economic Forum. Fan Gong, director of the National Economic Research Institute at the China Reform Foundation, said the issue for China isn't whether to devalue the yuan, that's the Chinese currency, but, quote, to limit it from the U.S. dollar, end quote. And here's the kicker. This Chinese economist, this is what he said, speaking in English, by the way. Like, you know, I really want you guys to get this. I'll say this in English. He says the U.S. dollar is no longer, in our opinion, is no longer seen as a stable currency and is devaluing all the time, and that's putting troubles all the time. Now, this is serious stuff. If the Chinese decide to stop buying dollars, if the Chinese decide to stop taking dollars, if the Chinese decide dollars aren't a good investment, we are in deep trouble. Because George W. Bush, with his trillion-dollar tax cuts for the rich, which were really borrowing from China so that he could give money to the rich, borrowing in the name of our children and grandchildren, thus the highest deficits in the history probably of the world, certainly of the United States. George W. Bush has put us totally at the mercy of the Chinese. They can bring our economy to its knees tomorrow. Fan, this Chinese economist, he says, if you do this in the beginning, you have some kind of initial shock. Yes, I would say so. Fan gets the Understatement of the Year award. The AP article goes on to say, the dollar hit a new low in December against the euro and has been falling against other major currencies on concerns about the ever-growing U.S. trade and budget deficits. And what are the Chinese up to? What they are up to is taking over the world. As Fan said, the first step to make 50 of the 500 largest companies in the world Chinese. He said it's probably about 10 years, at least 10 years, before the objective of the government of 50 of the largest 500 companies in the world being Chinese is achieved. And George W. and the Republicans in Congress, and many of the Democrats in Congress, probably the majority of them, frankly, are just right there. Let's sell us down the tubes. This is not good. I don't know how to say it. This is not good. And none of the cons want to talk about it because, you know, the Republicans control the House. They control the Senate. They control the Supreme Court. They control the White House. If anybody's going to do anything about it, it's going to have to be the Republicans. And they don't want to talk about it because it's all consistent with their economic worldview. What's good for the multinationals is good for the Republicans. And the Chinese are saying, yeah, you think so, huh? Well, we keep our multinationals under tight control here in China. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website, by the way, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, just click the live chat button. Paul in Detroit, Michigan on the line. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. I just wanted to mention that from Bloomberg Financial News and the New York Times, Riggs Bank, which is based in Washington, D.C., and handles 95% of the accounts from the embassies, or 95% of the embassy's accounts in the Washington, D.C. area, has pleaded guilty this morning to money laundering through offshore shell accounts between the CIA and dictatorships in South America, Africa, and the Middle East.
What a surprise.
Yeah, and the guilty plea, according to the New York Times, is expected to end the Justice Department's investigation into the bank. And none of the top executives in the bank have been charged with any crime. And this includes George W. Bush's uncle, Jonathan Bush,
right,
who is the top executive at that bank.
He's one of the directors of the bank, I believe. Yeah.
A wholly owned subsidiary of the bank, which deals it's a wholly owned subsidiary of the bank in which he's in charge of.
I see.
Anyway, the bank is currently a defendant in lawsuits for allegedly having accounts used to fund the 9/11 terrorist attack.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Paul, do you think that if you had been charged with money laundering, that you would avoid jail?
Only if I had enough money, because our justice system is based solely on money.
Yeah, it seems increasingly so. It seems increasingly so, in fact, in the United States of America, under these conservative policies ever since Reagan, in large part, that everything, your ability to survive, you want a liver transplant, you need a new kidney, you want health insurance, you want to get a decent education, you got to have the money.
That's right. Money means more than life in this country.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tom.
It means life. Thanks, Paul, for the call. I appreciate it, and for being an alert and vigilant person out there. Noticing, I saw there was, in fact, maybe it's in my third hour stack here. I've got some other economic stuff. I saw a story about a corporation that had pled guilty to a couple of major felonies today, and you know, maybe I didn't even clip it out. Maybe it was in the Wall Street Journal. It's not all that unusual, right? Why, when a corporation commits a felony, why don't we just say that's it and shut them down? I mean, you know, it'll create a hole in the marketplace that other people will fill. It'll provide an opportunity for decent people of you know, integrity to come in and say, okay, we're going to start a company to occupy that niche in the marketplace, that ecological niche, as it were. Why don't we go back to doing what we did during the first 100 years of this country? Regularly using the corporate death penalty. Corporation commits a crime three times, they're out. You're not a corporation anymore. Sorry, you got to dissolve. You got to sell all your assets. You know, return whatever you can to the stockholders, pay off your debts, and that's it. Out of business. This was done routinely in the United States up until the decade after the Civil War. The corporate death penalty was very common. It's called dechartering. In fact, there's a big movement in California right now to decharter Unocal, a company that Hamid Karzai used to work for. He's now the guy who's the head of Afghanistan, where Unocal wanted to build a gas and oil pipeline. By coincidence, just totally by coincidence. Elaine in Eureka, California on the line. By the way, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Hey, Elaine.
Yes, Tom. I was wanting to comment about the Republic of China and our problem there.
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware that our pulp mill here in Eureka on the Samoa Peninsula has been bought by a company from Hong Kong, China, the Republic of China?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. See, this is what happens, Elaine, when we run these huge trade deficits, and people don't very often distinguish between the trade deficit and the budget deficit. The budget deficit is when the government spends more money than it has and it borrows money in our children's name to give tax cuts to rich and folks and stuff like that, or to fight wars. The trade deficit is when we buy more from other countries than we sell to other countries. And so we end up having to essentially have IOUs with them. They end up with more dollars. We end up with more stuff in our Walmarts. What are they going to do with those dollars? Well, they could spend them here. This is the principal place to spend dollars. We're the producer of dollars. And so they come over here and they buy our companies. And then they run ads on television telling us, isn't it wonderful that we're giving you jobs?
Yeah.
I mean, they do. I saw this, I think it was a Toyota ad yesterday. It was we're great. And yeah, it's marvelous. I'm sure I'm sure the people working for them are very grateful to have the jobs. But frankly, I would rather have American companies offering those jobs so that the profits stay in the United States And those profits are used to build new businesses in the United States rather than those profits going to Japan or, in the case that you just mentioned, to China to start some other company that's going to compete with some other business here in the United States.
Yes, I was out to a car dealership recently, and I noticed a sticker on one of the cars, I believe it was a Kia, that said 87% of all parts will come from overseas.
Yeah. Well,
it doesn't help our employment problem, and we have one here.
No, it doesn't.
It,
and, you know, it's what's amazing to me is there was this big hoop-de-doop made a couple of weeks ago, I believe, maybe a month ago, about Dell Computer, how I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, might have been the New York Times, a big, you know, two-page spread and everything, how to do manufacturing in the United States. Dell Computer does it. Nobody else has figured out how to do it. Everybody else is importing their computers. Dell makes them here. You know, they're buying all their parts, not all of them, they're buying most of their parts overseas, they bring them here, and they pack it, they assemble them. This is not manufacturing. Assembly is not manufacturing,
Well, this government is certainly terrorizing the people of this country.
That's right, and it's a great way to keep power. Terror works, and George Bush is using it against us. And not just George Bush, there are Democrats in Congress who are just equally complicit in this. Elaine, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
It's nice to hear from you. And thanks for listening to us there in Eureka, California, on KTRC, KGOE, on Tom Seaborn station, a fine radio station. Paula sends me a note. She doesn't say where her city is. You know, when you send me a note on stuff like this, or when you post things on our message board, it tells where you live. When you first log on, you get to say, you know, that you can be a citizen of the world if you want, or you can say, I live in Wheeling, West Virginia, or whatever. Anyhow, Paula writes an email. She says, in my recent travels around the internet, I came across an article called, quote, mainstream economic views are mistaken, some myths and facts, end quote, by Everett Gross. And she gives me the link. And she says, I'm writing because some of what he says puzzles me, especially the impact of imports and exports. And I went to his page and I printed this stuff out, and it is bizarre. It is just very, very odd. For example, here is, according to this guy, and this is what's so dangerous. I mean, there are people out there promoting these. Well, it'll be self-evident. I don't have to rant about it before I tell you. Here we are. He says, myth. Our exports are good for our economy and imports are bad. Fact. Now, keep in mind, he's saying this is a fact. I'm not saying this is a fact. He says, fact. The opposite is true. If we could import all we want without ever exporting, we could be much richer than we are. If we could export all we want to and never import anything, we would become poor rapidly. Exporting serves no useful function at all except to make importation possible. Now, just think about this for a minute. If we could import all we want without ever exporting, we would be richer than we are. Well, if you import all you want without exporting, that's called stealing, because you have to export something. I mean, if you're not exporting goods in exchange for that stuff you're importing, you have to export dollars. And if you're exporting dollars, you're not becoming richer. I mean, just look around you in America here. Where are these jobs? Where is our economy? What's the fastest growing economy in the world right now? It's China. Why? Richard Nixon went over there. He opened up China. George Herbert Walker Bush, let's have fast track authority. Bill Clinton, let's have NAFTA and GATT. George W. Bush, most favored nation status. Let's drop our tariffs with China. Let's let them sell us anything they want at any price they want. Yeah, we've got some anti-dumping rules. They're a joke. So, number one, this statement doesn't make any sense. Number two, there is a grain of truth to the idea that importing can be better than exporting, but it depends on what you're importing and exporting. And this is the thing. This is the thing that people just like. It's really very simple. This is not rocket science. I mean, this is stuff you can explain to the people at the office around the water cooler. When you import raw materials, when you bring raw materials into the country and you add value to them, That is, you do something to them. Say you bring iron ore into the country, and you turn it into steel, and you make it into cars, and then you export the cars. What you have done is you have exported... I was going to say you've exported your labor. That sounds too much like Lou Dobbs' use. What you are doing is now you are getting other people in other countries to pay us here to do work, which is a desirable thing, right? In other words, you're creating jobs here in the United States. So that's a good thing. So if you import raw materials and you export finished goods, that's the definition of an industrialized nation. And that's generally considered to be a positive economic model. That is how Japan rose from the ashes of World War II, even though Japan has no natural resources other than the intellect of the Japanese people. They can barely grow enough food to feed themselves. They have no oil. They have no forests. They have forests left, but they don't have enough forests that they can cut them down and use them for fuel. They don't have gold. They don't have, they have virtually no natural resources. So how is it that Japan is an industrial powerhouse? They import raw material, they add value to it with labor, and they export the finished goods. Everybody else is paying the Japanese to build things for them. Now, the flip side of that is what you call a banana republic. And they're called banana republics because they traditionally exported bananas and imported finished goods. So if your country is bringing into it finished goods, you are paying other people to do the labor. You're creating jobs in other countries. And if you are exporting raw materials like timber, soybeans, iron ore, gold, whatever, if you're exporting raw materials, then just 20 years, 25 years since Ronald Reagan became president, we have gone from being the largest creditor to the largest debtor in the world, and from the largest exporter, one of the two largest exporters of finished goods, to one of the largest importers of finished goods, and we are now one of the largest exporters of raw materials. Conservatives have turned us into a banana republic.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brusho, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews. What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Us have better hearts.
This is your chance to meet other liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
Bonjour, my name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly, so I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO. We'll send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique! And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555. And mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
America's most famous naturalist compromised his broad view of wilderness to obtain a narrow set of goals, according to a Kansas historian. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. John Muir has been called a wilderness prophet, but historian Donald Worster says the naturalist's fight to save places like Yosemite diverted his passion for all wilderness into protecting select natural wonders.
It narrowed and focused on the national parks as the place to go find nature, and particularly the greatest, most beautiful became, for him, nature. And what lay outside those places was less and less interesting to him.
Worster is an environmental historian at the University of Kansas. He says rich, influential friends, people like Teddy Roosevelt and railroad tycoon Edward Harriman, helped Muir save Yosemite, but he says they also compromised the Scottish immigrants' ideals.
In a way, he became compromised by the wonderful linen sheets that he liked to sleep on in these people's houses, the little boutonniere they brought him in the morning. He became their kind of pet. And they would trot John Muir out and say, now tell us some wonderful stories about dogs and birds in your Scottish brogue. And he would light up and do what he was supposed to do.
Muir eventually helped create the National Park Service and founded the Sierra Club. But Worster says Muir seemed blind to the world outside the parks.
He would rail against greedy people trying to destroy Yosemite National Park. But he'd really connect that up to the economic system, and it was driving environmental change, much of it very destructive.
Muir's legacy is seen by millions of people who visit the national parks each year. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What do you call a tax cut for the wealthiest 1%?
Homeland Security.
What do you call the other 99 who can't make the rent?
Homeland Security.
A lovely little bit of phraseology for all the neocon men when they announce a massive deficit. Something that they could say to preface it. What do you call the cable guy who's rifling through your mail?
Homeland Security.
I love this.
What do you call it when you get arrested for clipping a nail?
Homeland Security.
Two little words that mean a shock in our campaign.
Enough of that. Anyhow, welcome back, Tom Hartman. With you, in fact, in our next hour, we're going to get into this issue of why is it that our Homeland Security Department is more show than substance, but that's a whole other topic. Just to wrap up these economic fallacies, these economic myths, another, again, from this conservative website, myth, imports of goods from a foreign country cause unemployment and other hardships here, right? He presents this as a myth. Fact, he says, that is false. Other causes, such as our own reverse system of taxes and subsidies, are much more than enough to cause all of our own unemployment. See, this is the use of rhetoric to say nothing. I mean, it's absolutely meaningless. The reality is, again, it depends on what you're importing. His myth, imports of goods from a foreign country cause unemployment and other hardships here. Yes, if you are importing goods that require a lot of labor to make them, then that labor is not being added to them here. It's being added to them somewhere else. So you don't have jobs here adding the labor. On the other hand, if you're importing things that will require labor to turn them into something else, then you're importing the raw materials that you can actually turn into jobs. The the basic, you know, there's just this foundational notion, and you need to recite it like a mantra. An industrialized nation, a fully developed nation, imports raw materials and exports finished goods to the extent that they do international trade. Whereas a banana republic, a third world country, finished goods, because they can't make them themselves anymore, they don't have the factories or the business, and they export raw materials. In other words, they give away their riches, the stuff that could be turned into something else. So they give away their potential, and they bring in finished goods. And that is from Reaganomics through Bushonomics through Clintonomics through Bushonomics. That is what we have now. After 200 years of being the preeminent, not just moral force in the world and military force in the world, but financial and industrial force in the world, we have become one of the world's largest third world nations as a consequence of conservative economic policies. And the fact that the average American just doesn't get this stuff. Inform people!
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242.
News of the day. This is
the CIO is launching a national grassroots fight to defend Social Security against the Bushization attempt. Actions in San Francisco and in Boston on Wednesday singled out financial firms like Charles Schwab, urging them not to assist Social Security privatization. Tim Paulson is the executive director of the San Francisco Labor Council.
Social Security is not broken. The only thing that's attempted to be broken is the promise to working men and women that when they retire that they will have guaranteed benefits. And we believe that corporate America is just drooling right now, waiting to get a piece of our retirement and to make sure that they can get profit off of it and to let it get into the speculative realm.
The AFL-CIO believes that private financial companies rocked by corporate crime and scandal in recent years should never be trusted to handle Social Security accounts. These rallies are only the opening rounds in labor's battle to defend Social Security.
Trade unions in Africa's last true monarchy are entering a second day of strikes aimed at democratic reforms. Swaziland has begun drafting a constitution that the Federation of Trade Unions says will give the monarchy more power. King Mswati III has been criticized of living a rich lifestyle while most of the country's population lives in poverty. More than a third of Swazis are HIV positive. The union is seeking a constitution that will include separation of power between branches of government, as well as a respect for women and human rights. In Boston, a civil suit against a union that represents uniformed officers with the rank of sergeant or higher began this week. The suit was filed 3 years ago by Karen Kelly, a former bookkeeper for the Boston Superior Officers Federation. She claims in the suit that the union allowed its former vice president, Thomas W. Nolan, to sexually harass her. Kelly says between September 1999 and December 2000, Nolan repeatedly called her indecent pet names and sent her emails and left phone messages asking for sexual favors. The lawsuit alleges that when Kelly refused Nolan, her pay was cut, work conditions changed, and her workload increased. According to the Boston Globe, Federation President Joseph Gillespie says Kelly wasn't harassed and her pay was cut as a cost-saving measure. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The Multinational Monitor has released its top 10 worst companies of 2004, topping the list, Abbott Laboratories. According to the Monitor, at the end of 2003, Abbott raised the price of its life-or-death anti-AIDS drug, Norvir, by 400%. The company claims that the increase was to cover research and development. The stipulation, the price increase does not apply if purchased along with another Abbott drug. Critics say that gives Abbott an unfair market advantage and forces users to only use their drugs.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Are you tired of progressives spending all their energy on defensive struggles where a victory simply maintains the status quo? We are too, and we're doing something about it. At ReclaimDemocracy.org, we're taking the initiative to revoke corporate power and restore citizen authority over corporations to enable genuine progress on the many issues that we all care about. Get involved. Visit us online at ReclaimDemocracy.org or call 406-582-1224.
A bumper year for U.S. jobs, exclaimed the headline in my local daily paper. Wow, that's good news, right? The boom must be back. Read further, and you learn that job creation is not even keeping pace with the increasing number of working-age Americans. And way down in the story, you find this sentence. The increase in jobs was not translating into increases in wages. That's good news for CEOs, but bad news for the average American. Yes, say corporate economists and the Bushites, but it's bound to get better soon, just like we've been promising. Trust us. Again. I was in Southern California recently, and a local paper offered its 2005 jobs forecast for Orange County, one of the most prosperous places in America. There will be new jobs, the story said, but don't expect to live high on the hog. The 10 occupations expecting the most job growth were retail sales, security guards, cashiers, food service, janitorial, wait staff, nurses, telephone customer service, laborers, and landscapers. Only one of these pays anything approaching a middle-class wage, and most pay what amounts to poverty wages in Orange County. Meanwhile, the one boom that really is underway is a job crusher, corporate mergers. For example, Kmart is taking over Sears, Sprint is swallowing Nextel, and Oracle is absorbing PeopleSoft. Looking at the merger surge expected this year, one analyst gushed, "Corporate America has finally gotten a bit of swagger back in its step." This is Jim Hightower saying, "Dandy. We need economic growth, not economic consolidation. Corporate profits are way up, and cash flow is at a record rate of $1.3 trillion a year. But instead of increasing wages and opening new factories, swaggering CEOs are diverting America's investment capital into buying out their competitors, shrinking both jobs and consumer choice."
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac, who's facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac. The libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what. Support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library. So make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Interesting conversation in the chat room. I thought a mullet was a fish, too. Hopefully I'm not in trouble with the FCC now. Welcome back to our program. Got an email here from Linda. She's in Atlanta, Georgia. And she says, I'm on John Kerry's supporters email list, and he, they have sent out an occasional message since the so-called election. You know, let's cover all the kids. We have here in Vermont, for example, the Dr. Dinosaur program. There's this kind of Barney dinosaur that promotes it, right, to kids in the state. An idea that Howard Dean came up with. And anybody up to 100% of poverty, which is pretty low, it's like 10,000, 11,000. I'm not sure what the poverty level is here, is right now, but for a family of four, but it's in that neighborhood. Up to 100% of poverty, free health insurance for their kids, paid for by the state, through Medicaid. To 125%, it's $10 a month. Up to 150%, it's like $15 or $20, something like that. $14,000, a little less than $15,000 a year for a family of four. And I don't understand how anybody can raise a family of four on $14,000 a year working full-time and still have money left over to pay for health insurance without some sort of a subsidy or some program like this. It just doesn't compute. But in any case, it's a start. But here I had an awakening this morning. I got this email from Linda, and she says, John Kerry's program is going to essentially drive this thing through Medicaid and make it compulsory. And I did, you know, I did a little research, and I think I figured this thing out. And I may be wrong, and if there's some Kerry supporters out there who I've missed something, please call and set me straight, but I don't think I have. This is on John Kerry's website, johnkerry.com/petition/billsummary.php. The Kids Come First Act, it's Senate Bill 114, S-114. And Kerry says, the Kids Come First Act is a true federal-state partnership where the best elements of shared responsibility contribute to an affordable, reliable, comprehensive system of care for all children. Well, he's leaving something out of the equation there. At least the way it would work here in Vermont. The Dr. Dinosaur program in Vermont is administered by Blue Cross Blue Shield. Or so I was informed this morning by a friend of mine who works in that field. And in fact, this is what Linda pointed out to me in her email. John Kerry is apparently proposing something that sounds like a really good idea, but in my humble opinion, I'm sorry, I don't mean this to be partisan in any way. I voted for John Kerry. But seems to me to combine the worst parts of the conservative worldview with the worst parts of the liberal worldview. He's suggesting, now see, the liberal worldview says, okay, there's stuff that we all do, we all get together as a community, and we make sure that we're not living in a nation where children have leprosy and they're banging on your door begging for money. I've read on the air here in the last, just this week, now two emails I've gotten from people living in suburban neighborhoods where kids in the neighborhood that they know, I mean local families, have been going door to door selling beadwork and things to try to raise money because they're being evicted from their homes because they can't afford to pay their bills. Because one of the parents lost their job. It went off to India. It went off to China. It went off to now Pakistan is starting a high-tech business. So anyhow, so there's the liberals among us say, well, you know, when people fall on hard times, and it's not because they're lazy, and it's not because they've decided that they want to, you know, live tribally like, you know, on railroad cars like, you know, the hobos in the 20s or something. Although I would argue that the majority of them would rather have had a job and a home. But rather, it's the circumstances beyond their control. The economy fell apart. When that happens, we are going to collectively say, you know, we have some responsibility to these folks. And we're going to say, we're going to take some of our tax dollars and make sure that there is, you know, we're going to cut poverty in the United States. The Lyndon Johnson's programs, as much as they're reviled, cut poverty in the United States by 50%, by half. This is a major leap forward. Dramatically increased social mobility. His programs like Affirmative Action made it possible for Condoleezza Rice to get where she is today. And Colin Powell, both of them used Affirmative Action programs. This is, you know, this is kind of the liberal worldview. I think that's a good, yeah, this is a good thing. And then the conservative worldview is, well, anything that is done should be done with a profit to somebody who runs a big corporation. If there's no profit in it, it ain't good. Ronald Reagan in his first inaugural address, government is not the solution to our problems, government is the problem. So we should privatize our fire departments, our police departments. We should put toll booths on all our roads and sell them off to AT&T. We should privatize our water supply, privatize our septic, put ourselves totally at the mercy of big corporations. Well, here now you've got John Kerry. And I'm frankly astounded by this. You got John Kerry suggesting both. Let's create a law which says that you must insure your child. If you don't, you've broken the law. This is using the force of government. This is what conservatives are worried about, the force of government. They say liberals are too quick to use the force of government. You got John Kerry saying, let's pass a law that you must insure your child, and if you can't afford it, and his definition of if you can't afford it has to do with if your income is, well, here, rather than trying to describe it, let me just read it. The bill requires parents to insure all children under age 19 and requires proof of their coverage. I'm reading to you from John Kerry's website. It will also allow higher-income parents to the right to buy into the SCHIP program for their children at cost, allowing parents to use the SCHIP subsidy to purchase qualified employer-sponsored coverage and providing tax credits to higher-income parents to maintain coverage affordability. Parents will not be required to spend any more than 5% of their adjusted gross income on health care premiums for their children under age 19. Now, first of all, this is incredible. This is way too complicated. It sounds like one of Kerry's campaign speeches. And secondly, you're going to now tell the American people, we're going to require you to buy health insurance. And here's the kicker. The insurance is administered by for-profit companies. This is the same thing as the car insurance laws. And I have to tell you, I have a problem with them too. And maybe I'm not liberal enough. Somehow I don't think that this is conservative or liberal to say, here's my take on the car insurance things. If the state is going to pass a law saying it is in the good of all of us that everyone who's driving have insurance, and I agree with that, I don't want myself or a member of my family to be hit by somebody else and incur medical bills or even the repair expenses for the car and have that person not have the insurance to pay for it. I don't think it's right. But when the government tells me that I have to buy that insurance, I would like to know that the insurance companies who are now selling their product to me by force of government mandate, if I don't do it, you know, as the libertarians say, men with guns will come. And ultimately it could come to that. I would like to know that those insurance companies that are selling that to me are doing it in a way that does not generate profit for them. In other words, I think that, you know, just like hospitals used to be required to be nonprofit, that healthcare, you know, health insurance providers used to be required to be not-for-profit corporations. The Red Cross is not-for-profit. In my opinion, if you're going to mandate insurance and you're going to have non-governmental providers, they must be non-profit. I'm very uncomfortable with the fact that we've got for-profit corporations who are putting profit above our interests. I've told the story before. We moved into Vermont. Vermont has some fairly strong laws that protect you against insurance companies, predatory insurance companies. And we had our car insurance with one of the cheapest, one of the companies that advertises like crazy that they're one of the cheapest car insurance companies in the world. And as soon as I had a claim, and it was my first claim in like 15 years, and I've been with this company at least that many years, maybe 20 years. First claim, they dropped me. And the same thing, and my brother-in-law moved into this state, same thing. Only it wasn't even a claim, they just dropped him. I called the insurance commissioner, and they say, oh yeah, that company drops everybody when they move into this state. Why? Because this state has laws that doesn't allow insurance companies to screw people. If the government is going to mandate something, I'd like to know that that program is being run by people who are accountable to we the people. A nonprofit corporation that can lose its tax-exempt status if it doesn't follow particular accounting rules, in other words, lose its right to sell that insurance. And if we're going to have government-mandated health care, which I think we should, why don't we simply expand the Medicare program? Why don't we simply say Medicare, which works just fine other than this silly drug benefit where you know, with the donut hole and the government can't negotiate cheap prices, the $300 billion welfare provision for the pharmaceutical companies. Let's fix that and simply make Medicare available to everybody. Then you would have the same system the rest of the world has. Why not just do it simple? 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Bonjour. My name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Hank Montenegro of Morganville, New Jersey wrote, "Dear Mr. Oric, ever since we purchased your 8-pound Oric XL vacuum, my wife has been in heaven. Recently, she panicked, believing she'd broken the vacuum. I contacted your customer service department, and after a few questions, I was sent a replacement part at no charge. The machine is as good as new. Try my 8-pound Oric XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200.
Do you have a child with ADHD who is misunderstood, unhappy, and dissatisfied with school? Are you ready for an educational change and for your child to like school again? Consider The Hunter School, a residential K-8 school specializing in the education of children with ADHD, hunters in a farmer's world. Hunter School appreciates and honors the uniqueness of each student while building upon his inherent strengths and abilities. For more information, find us on the web at hunterschool.org.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, okay, it was a rhetorical question, I suppose. The rhetorical question being, why don't we simply go with Medicare and extend it to everybody? And the obvious answer about why we don't is because it would mean that all the health insurance companies would go out of business. Now, the simple reality is that that mass unemployment that would be caused by all the health insurance companies going out of business would be a small drop in the economy. I mean, it would be you would be losing as many jobs as you lose in an average 2 or 3 month period simply as a result of the normal Bush economic policies. But you would also be eliminating an industry that makes billions of dollars a year, that employs an army of lobbyists, that hands millions of dollars to politicians. Now, you want to know about this industry? Go see Warren Beatty's movie Bullworth. You'll have to rent it. It's been 5 years or so since it came out. Just a marvelous movie about how the health insurance industry works with politicians. So that's the answer. No politician is willing, to the best of my knowledge. I mean, Bernie Sanders is willing to say it, I think. He certainly called for single-payer health care. I believe he has in our conversations on this program every Friday. Dennis Kucinich has said it. Paul Wellstone used to talk about it. But few and far between are the politicians who will stand up and say, okay, let's simply put an end to the health insurance industry in the United States. We don't need it anymore. We don't need leeches on our backs, metaphorically speaking. We need real health care. 1-866-889-8894. Lynn in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Lynn, how you doing today?
Pretty good. How you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
You prompted me to call when you said you didn't think you were liberal enough when you're talking about the Kerry bill. That didn't sound liberal to me at all. That sounded very conservative to me. Anyway, I was shocked about that. And I was thinking also,
Hang on just a second, Lynn. Yeah. I don't understand what you just said. I was being facetious, but
oh, okay. I took it as serious. Okay.
Okay. Because I went on to say, I believe that we should all of us collectively make sure that none of us are in need and that none of us are wanting for health care.
Yeah.
But I also agree with the conservatives that the force of government is a fearsome thing. And it should only be used in extreme circumstances. Now, I consider healthcare to be an extreme circumstance.
Yeah.
And I'm absolutely opposed to the idea of using the force of government to promote the benefits and the interests of private corporations.
Which brings up my second point.
Which puts me at odds with both liberals and conservatives, by the way.
Yeah. So. Which brings up my second point is if the government's going to require that we have this healthcare, I believe the government should pay for it.
Well, that's my point. And see, the government is us, and so we are paying for it, no matter what.
Yes.
And here we have this. Here's an interesting juxtaposition for you, Lynn. You know, your Social Security tax is what, 12%, 13%, 14%, something like that. When you add it all up together, I think 12.6 sticks in my head.
Yeah.
Medicare tax is what, 2.6, 3.1. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's quite low. You know why the difference?
No.
because Bill Gates is paying Medicare even on the second million and third million that he makes.
Oh.
George W. Bush is paying Medicare tax on $100,000, $200,000, on all the millions that he makes, whereas all of these guys are only paying Social Security tax in the first $90,000 that they make.
Yeah, I think they should. I think you're right. They should pay it on the whole bill of wax.
That's right. And if you were to take the Medicare if you were to eliminate the cap on Social Security, that problem is solved. And if you were to take the Medicare tax and simply increase it by 1 or 2 percentage points, we could cover everybody in the United States for free. And the only problem is it would put out of business all the health insurance companies in this country.
I think that's a good thing.
I do, too. But you won't find it. You find me a politician who will say that.
I voted for Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah, okay. Well, your moral integrity is intact, Lynn. I salute you. I'm impressed. Unfortunately, Dennis Kucinich, I mean, you're in California. He wasn't run. You're talking about in the primaries.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Because when it came to the actual election, there wasn't that option.
Yeah, you know? I bit my tongue and voted for Kerry.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And I still think he would have made a good president. But boy, this concerns me.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Democrats have to get a spine. Harry Truman proposed single-payer health care. Why can't, you know, I'm ranting. Thanks a lot for the call, Lynn. We got to move along. 29 minutes past the hour.
Love rules.
Our son gets mad. He tries to shout.
We'll take away his cell phone, his video game.
And if we have to, we'll take away his freedom.
He's got to understand that there will be consequences for breaking our rules.
It doesn't matter that he's not smoking. When we say not to hang out with the weed crowd,
we mean it.
That's what it takes to keep him away from marijuana.
And we love him enough to live with that.
Love, the anti-drug. Call 1-800-788-2800 or visit theantidrug.com for information on how to prevent your child from using marijuana. Sponsored by the ONDCP and the Partnership for Drug-Free America.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO is launching a national grassroots fight to defend Social Security against the Bush privatization attempt. Actions in San Francisco and in Boston on Wednesday singled out financial firms like Charles Schwab, urging them not to assist Social Security privatization. Tim Paulson is the executive director of the San Francisco Labor Council.
Social Security is not broken. The only thing that's attempted to be broken is the promise to working men and women that when they retire that they will have guaranteed benefits. And we believe that corporate America is just drooling right now, waiting to get a piece of our retirement and to make sure that they can get profit off of it and to let it get into the speculative realm.
The AFL-CIO believes that private financial companies rocked by corporate crime and scandal in recent years should never be trusted to handle Social Security accounts. These rallies are only the opening rounds in labor's battle to defend Social Security.
Trade unions in Africa's last true monarchy are entering a second day of strikes aimed at democratic reforms. Swaziland has begun drafting a constitution that the Federation of Trade Unions says will give the monarchy more power. King Mswati III has been criticized of living a rich lifestyle while most of the country's population lives in poverty. More than a third of Swazis are HIV positive. The union is seeking a constitution that will include separation of power between branches of government, as well as a respect for women and human rights. In Boston, a civil suit against a union that represents uniformed officers with the rank of sergeant or higher began this week. The suit was filed 3 years ago by Karen Kelly, a former bookkeeper for the Boston Superior Officers Federation. She claims in the suit that the union allowed its former vice president, Thomas W. Nolan, to sexually harass her. Kelly says between September 1999 and December 2000, Nolan repeatedly called her indecent pet names and sent her emails and left phone messages asking for sexual favors. The lawsuit alleges that when Kelly refused Nolan, her pay was cut, work conditions changed, and her workload increased. According to the Boston Globe, Federation President Joseph Gillespie says Kelly wasn't harassed and her pay was cut as a cost-saving measure. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The Multinational Monitor has released its top 10 worst companies of 2004. Topping the list, Abbott Laboratories. According to the Monitor, at the end of 2003, Abbott raised the price of its life-or-death anti-AIDS drug, Norvir, by 400%. The company claims that the increase was to cover research and development. The stipulation, the price increase does not apply if purchased along with another Abbott drug. Critics say that gives Abbott an unfair market advantage and forces users to only use their drugs.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I want to move on from this thing, and just a final point. What we're seeing right now is an attempt to reverse engineer Social Security from where our healthcare system should be to where it is, only in the field of Social Security. In other words, with Social Security, you have a program where we pay into it, and a bunch of boring government bureaucrats who earn modest salaries, you know, just basic civil service salaries, handle literally trillions of dollars and have done so for over 70 years without a penny being embezzled, without a single CEO earning $100 million a year, with no private jets with gold-plated faucets in the bathrooms, with no corporate CEO headquarters, with none of that stuff. Very methodical, boring, wonderful folks at the Social Security Administration who have just simply made sure that the checks go out every month. And the cost of Social Security has been very steady for 70 years, right around more or less about 1%. By the way, let me just add with Social Security, everybody's talking about, we're going to start spending more than we bring in 2018. Social Security was pay-as-you-go right up until the middle of the Reagan presidency. In other words, it was spending out what it was bringing in. And around that time, folks said, hey, the baby boomers are going to retire. We need to start saving up for that. And so they raised the Social Security tax to build up a trust fund to handle this. In other words, it is supposed to go negative in 2018 so that it can pay out benefits to 2014. It's supposed to. And then once that demographic bulge is gone, it'll bounce right back up. But anyhow, what we have with Social Security is what we should have with healthcare, which is where you've got a system where everybody pays into it. You know, everybody pays into it a small and reasonable amount. And when you need the service, it's there. And there are, and about a third of the people who are taking Social Security are not retired people. Social Security is not a retirement program. It includes that as a component. But it's really not even a retirement program as a component. It's a retirement safety net. It's to prevent abject, total disaster, dog food poverty, as we had in the 20s and 30s before Social Security came along among our elderly. But if you break your neck and you're paralyzed, or if you're a child and your parents die in a horrific accident, whatever, Social Security is there for you too. All right, so Social Security is larger than just retirement. Similarly, we need a medical system in the United States that we all pay into, and we have one nice, boring agency in Washington, D.C. that pays the bills. Very simple. It works in every other industrialized country in the world. Now, a few have more bells and whistles than that. In the U.K., for example, the government owns a good chunk of the healthcare system, many of the hospitals, private physicians' offices and whatnot, local surgeries and things. I don't think that that's a good idea, frankly. There's a debate about it going on in the UK. But that's a small point. You know, should we have something that's more like socialized medicine like the UK, or should we have something that's more like single-payer healthcare like they have in Germany or Canada? That's something we can discuss. But what Kerry is proposing here is essentially privatized Social Security only in the medical area. That is, let's take this government-mandated payment, just like Social Security. I mean, this is another thing. This is another one of those areas where Barry Goldwater would be rolling over in his grave at George W. Bush, where Bush is saying, let's take government-mandated contributions and give them, they're required. You don't pay the taxes, you go to jail. They're required. And give them to private corporations so that they can take their fees, they can make their money on it. I don't think so. I just don't think so. It's, in fact, here, let me just, with regard to Social Security, President George Bush speaking to the Chilean president, quote, "Members of Congress should take some lessons from Chile, particularly when it comes to how to run our pension plans. Our Social Security system needs to be modernized, Mr. President, and I look forward to getting some suggestions as to how to do so, since you have done it so well." That's George Bush talking to the president of Chile. You can find it on whitehouse.gov/releases/2001/04/2001-0416-5HTML. Here's the fact from the New York Times, January 27th, 2005. This is today's New York Times. And I quote, "Chile's retirees find shortfall in private plan." The headline. "Many middle-class workers who contributed regularly are finding that their private accounts, burdened with hidden fees that may have soaked up as much as a third of their original investment, are failing to deliver as much in benefits as they would have received if they had stayed in the old system." We have to do. Maybe the first step is to do it in a way that the health insurance companies can get their hands on that money. But somehow I suspect that if we don't just kill that beast right off, its claws will get so deeply into that system, as the pharmaceutical companies have into Medicare, its claws will get so deeply into it that we, the people, will not have the power to extricate them. And so, Mr. Kerry, I say to you, please correct me if I'm wrong, or, assuming I'm not, and I'm pretty sure I'm not, withdraw this proposal and submit a plan for single-payer health care. We need a health care system that works the same way Social Security does, the same way Medicare does. Another nice, boring system that doesn't make a profit for anybody. Well, now George Bush got a hold of it. Now it makes a profit for the drug companies. Of course, we need to strip that stupid provision out that says that the government, by law, cannot negotiate with pharmaceutical companies to get good prices, that everybody has to pay retail. I'm still dumbfounded. But anyhow, let's change that. I want to move along. We have done this topic to death. Strike one. Yeah, George W. Bush is fond of baseball metaphors. Intervention Magazine has an interesting article by Fred Viskovich today. Strike one, weapons of mass destruction. This is about Iraq. WMDs. Turns out there weren't any. You know that by now, I'm assuming. And strike two. 9/11. There was no relationship between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. None whatsoever. Right. You know that now, too. I'm assuming you know that. People who watch Fox News actually don't know this stuff. People who listen to Hannity don't know this stuff. 70% of the people who voted for George W. Bush don't know these two simple facts, that there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, haven't been since 1991. And that there was no relationship to 9/11. Now, George W. would have you think otherwise, of course. You know, he will go on and on about these things.
"This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas."
Yeah. Well, we know that your father and his business partner sold that to them back in the 80s, but not that it's there now. In fact, Saddam gave us 14,000 pages of document showing that it wasn't there. The weapons and Ritter supervised the destruction of most of it, said it's not there. This, by the way, keep in mind, this was in the context of a speech about Saddam Hussein. So this is Bush's attempt to tie Saddam into 9/11.
We've experienced the horror of September the 11th. We have seen that those who hate America are willing to crash airplanes into buildings full of innocent people. Our enemies would be no less willing. In fact, they would be eager to use biological or chemical or a nuclear weapon.
And therefore, Bush said, I would say this strike three, maybe we have to have four strikes. Strike three, no nuclear weapons, after Bush had said,
facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Which leaves us now with this final argument. Saddam Hussein was a vicious, horrible tyrant who killed people and put them in mass graves. And this is where it gets really interesting. Here's the pitch, writes Fred Biskovich. There are between 300,000 and 400,000 bodies contained within 260 to 270 mass graves. The mass graves announcement was made on November 8, 2003, by Sandra Hodgkinson, at the time the director of the Provisional Authority's Mass Grave Action Plan. Okay, this was Paul Bremer's bunch marketing to us the idea that there were 300,000 to 400,000 bodies in mass graves. She reported that there were, quote, reports, end quote, from Iraqis, and that they believed the estimates of sites and bodies. She said that they had confirmed 40 sites and identified 2,115 bodies. But in July of 2004, 6 months ago, Tony Blair's office admitted that the number of bodies that had been found in mass graves had been exaggerated. The number of bodies was put at 5,114. Not 300,000, not 400,000, 5,114. Now, that's still pretty bad. They further stated that the remaining 215 suspected grave sites, they're still working on this. The larger numbers, they said, were only based on estimates of estimates. And when forensic teams went to the sites, claims of 10,000 buried converted into a few hundred. The British are the source of the USAID's report on the subject. Here's a quote from Amnesty International. In June, more than 60 prisoners were said to have been executed at Abu Ghraib prison near Baghdad. Most had reportedly been arrested in the aftermath of the March 1991 uprising against the government. This was the slaughter of the Shiites. 60. In September, at least 100 political prisoners, including 21 women, were reportedly executed and their bodies buried in mass graves. End of quote from Amnesty International. Or consider this May 2003 announcement, again from Amnesty International. Amnesty International delegates have discovered a mass grave at Abu Qasib. They were provisionally able to determine that the grave was from 1991, as two Iraqi civilians present at the site were reportedly able to identify their fathers from the clothing on the two corpses. The grave holds approximately 40 bodies. It is a mass grave, 40 bodies. We have discovered, apparently, that Saddam was, over a 25-year period, killed about 5,000 people. Now, to put that on this on the scale of Hitler and the Holocaust, which is something that the conservatives and the neocons have been trying to do in re-justifying this war, to say, oh, Saddam, he was the worst dictator since Hitler, this kind of stuff. This is crazy. Fred writes, if the American public comes to the realization that there was no other justification for going into Iraq than some unvoiced set of neoconservative theories about how America can and should conquer the world, the messianic second term of the Bush crusade is over. To exaggerate the scale of human liquidation for geopolitical ends is the moral equivalent of a capital crime, not a successful at-bat in a political game. If mass graves is George Bush's strike three, then we should call him out. Interesting. That concerns me. That really concerns me. And then here it's like, you know, creating phony enemies You know, killing 5,000 people, that's pretty bad. Mugabe has killed a few million. I mean, you want mass graves, go to Burma. Go to Zimbabwe. I mean, really big mass graves. Look at what Cambodia did. Not recently, of course, but as a consequence, in large part, you could say, of our involvement in Vietnam. Brought to power Pol Pot. Here now we also have Antonin Scalia, Supreme Court Chief Justice Antonin Scalia, in Baton Rouge recently, last Saturday, addressing the Knights of Columbus, talking about how there is this huge anti-Christian conspiracy in America. He says, if I brought any message today, it's this: have the courage to have your wisdom regarded as stupidity, be fools for Christ, and have the courage to suffer the contempt of the sophisticated world. Where, one wonders, is this contempt for Christianity? In Scalia's nightmarish fantasy, he's constantly fighting a culture that hates religion and mocks Christianity. Where are these bigots? He doesn't say. They must be hiding well, ridiculing people of faith in secret. For the rest of us, our society is dominated by Christians who are proud of their religious tradition. Our president brags of having been born again after having defeated a candidate in 2000 who professed himself of asking himself, what would Jesus do? And another in 2004 boasted about attending weekly church services and having been an altar boy. Gotta have an enemy, I guess. 10 minutes before the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members at DemocraticMatch.com, you don't drink right-wing Kool-Aid. Right, Brush?
Right-wing wackos are fine to laugh at on all their radio programs, but no one wants to date one, right?
DemocraticMatch.com is a dating site made specifically for Democrats and other progressive individuals who want to date those with similar worldviews. What do you think of Democrats these days, Brush?
Democrats are smarter. Democrats are more evolved. Democrats are more fun. Democrats make better lovers. Democrats have better hearts.
Bitter liberals who listen to Tom Hartman, people who cherish the principles of our democracy, believe in a woman's right to choose, believe in protecting our incredible planet. In short, DemocraticMatch.com gives you the opportunity to meet a real soulmate. So what have you got to lose? Sign up today at DemocraticMatch.com.
Real novelists don't go to graduate school, they go to prison. Mike Palasek is one of America's newest, most exciting political storytellers. Palasek is a former federal prisoner for peace, county commissioner, city jail prisoner, Iowa Democratic Party candidate for Congress, football co-captain, small-town newspaper reporter, and bakery delivery truck driver. Check out www.iowapeace.com for Mike's books and read his weekly Is This Heaven? The View from Iowa. Go to iowapeace.com for ordering information for Twins, Joe Coffey's Revolution, KGB, The Truth, The Last Liberal Outlaw, and Prophets Without Honor. Palasek's books are recommended by Howard Zinn, Danny Schechter, BlueEar.com, The Des Moines Register, and Prisoners Everywhere.
For thousands of years, millions of people have trusted the healing power of herbs. Healing Hollers, an earth-based business in the southern Ozarks, has formulated medical herbal salves proven effective in promoting healing and providing relief for many skin conditions, including a healing salve with antiseptic and antibacterial properties to treat cuts, burns, scalds, and wounds, an antifungal salve safe and effective for athlete's foot, ringworm, nail, and other fungal infections, and a soothing calendula salve to reduce pain and inflammation from dry skin, eczema, and rashes, including diaper rash. These salves contain only herbs and roots organically grown or ethically wildcrafted natural oils and beeswax from the Ozarks. To learn more about these salves and other natural products from Healing Hollers, go to www.healing-hollers.com. That's www.healing-hollers.com.
Ice ages have chilled the earth for billions of years, but their origin remains unproven. I'm Steve Poplin for Earthwatch Radio.
Scientists have found evidence of an ice age some 3 billion years ago, the earliest known, but they still aren't sure what causes these periodic deep freezes. Doug McDougall is an earth scientist at the University of California, San Diego, and author of a new book called Frozen Earth. He says three main factors seem required to set off an ice age. The most influential one is the Earth's uneven path around the sun.
The energy that we get from the sun is one of the main things that determines the temperature on the surface of the Earth. And the Earth's orbit around the sun varies quite substantially. So that certainly has an impact on whether the Earth's surface is cool or warm.
McDougall says a second factor is the composition of the atmosphere, especially levels of greenhouse gases.
Particularly carbon dioxide is the greenhouse gas that probably has the most influence on regulating Earth's surface temperatures in terms of whether or not an ice age can start.
The third factor is the position of the continents, which move slowly about the Earth's surface.
So when there are continents near the poles, as there are today, the Antarctic, for example, it's easier for ice to build up in those cold regions. Once that happens, the ice reflects sunlight, reflects solar energy can start.
The third factor is the position of the continents, which move slowly about the Earth's surface.
So when there are continents near the poles, as there are today, the Antarctic, for example, it's easier for ice to build up in those cold regions. Once that happens, the ice reflects sunlight, reflects solar energy, and eventually the whole Earth's climate cools.
McDougall says the Earth has been in an ice age for nearly 3 million years. Our current warm spell is a temporary break from the advance of glaciers, but they're not likely to return for thousands of years. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Through a hole. It's coming from fires of the homeless from the
hopefully. Because we are 28-2000. According to USA Today, as a congressional candidate in 1978. Now, 1978, let's see, that's 1980 is 25 years ago, 1978 would be 27 years ago. 27 years ago, George W. Bush said, and I quote, Social Security will go broke in 10 years. 1988. That's when it was supposed to go broke. He said it was a crisis. It needed to be fixed. And what was the fix? Privatize the system. Hand it over to his campaign contributors and his family's friends in the financial services industry. You know, his father with the Carlyle Group, is an investment company. Sure, you can invest in the Carlyle Group. Now, I think their minimum investment is in the tens of thousands of dollars. But nonetheless. And now here we have a tragic situation for the Republican Party. This is a variation on the point that I was just making a minute ago, which is that the con strategy is to create phony bugaboos, evil guys, and then go after them. Oh, there's those atheists out there to get Christianity, and they drag out some poor schmuck from California who maybe he makes a point, but they get him all over Fox News, right? There's one guy. He's not speaking for America. Well, now the Republican Party, they're trying to raise money. They've started a fundraising drive asking donors to finance their efforts to get Bush's message, quote, past the liberal media filter. Yeah, they need a lot of help to get past the liberal media filter. Brian Williams on NBC now saying that he listens to Rush every single day, considers it his duty. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. It's Tom Hartman.
truth and common sense in broadcasting. For a change.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for them.